PHI.
I did go semi-looking.
Sellers is actually her last name. Holy cow. Well, you're banging around there, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the House Interim Committee on Business and Labor. Thank you all for being here. Decided to do informational meetings today to try to educate ourselves on some issues today. And we're going to start off with hearing about real estate and mortgage trends in Oregon. And as it's a pretty key part to business in Oregon, lending and such. So without further ado, I will bring up Byron Hendricks and Sean Cleave.
Sean
Jillian. The last ditch effort. So anyway, welcome to the committee. I appreciate you being here and talking to us a little bit about real estate and property values and what it looks like in Oregon today. Basically, we haven't had a discussion on this subject matter for quite some time since the recession had hit and we were all in turmoil, and we've had a few years since then, and just wanted to hear from the industry. So welcome.
Thank you, Representative Bynum and committee members. I appreciate the time for you. Would you obviously there's a lot of news.
And you need to introduce yourself as well.
Thank you very much. I'm Byron Hendricks from Salem, Oregon. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Realtors. I'm also president of Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Real Estate Professionals along the I-5 corridor of Oregon. So and I have a duty also with the Realtor Association to I'm the political coordinator with Representative Schrader in Congress on housing issues. So this is an area that we spend some time trying to help everybody understand what's there. The news is obviously pretty prevalent on a lot of issues about shortage of housing, and Oregon is no exception from that. We were short in 2007, which was really for Oregon the start of the recession. Everybody else went into six, and some of us thought we were going to get escape it, but we had it. But we were had a shortage there, and the shortage has become acute now, is the reality, and you're seeing it from homeless issues, you're seeing it from affordability issues and a number of things. And so I'll share some statistics with you, not many, but I'm glad to answer any questions about any part of the state. And obviously Oregon's a big state, and you've got some areas of the market that don't have much activity, and you know they may have, well, actually I think Baker County has like 11 months supply of inventory, and you've read in the press that a 6 month supply is a balanced market. There's a mix of sellers and buyers, and there should be reasonable turn times for homes that are there. The short area is obviously I-5 corridor of Oregon, really for the northern portion from Lane County up to the Tri-County area, where there's less than 2 months worth of inventory in some of those areas. And so that's really a result, as I think you're all aware, of the lack of the homes that have been built. And Echo Northwest has done the study on it, and they're looking at it and say, really, we need... we're underbuilt by 155,000 units, you know. So if we had been building through the recession, we weren't building enough homes pre-recession even. The shortage is there. And when you think about America in general, just organic growth is 1.75% and an average of three people per household. It's really 2.7 on a national statistic basis. They were building about a million homes a year. So they didn't even hit organic growth, let alone any kind of migration issues that are there. So this shortage, is, as Echo Northwest says, it's built up over the past 15 years, but they feel that we need 30,000 units a year in Oregon just to catch up, and we're currently building 17,000 units per year. So it's a big, big spread, and part of that, as you look at it, certainly homes get built by speculators. Homes get built by citizens that want to build a home, and there's a mix of reasons why it isn't always done. One is confidence. So a consumer that thought, well, I'd like to build my dream home, is saying, you know, well, what happens? To build now, obviously, there's probably a premium for new construction over resale homes of somewhere in the neighborhood of 30%. It costs 30% more to build something than you could buy a comparable property on the marketplace. That's due to labor shortages primarily. Most of the trades left Oregon during the recession. We haven't trained enough people for the trades to go back in and help rebuild that. There's some great things happening with the Career Technical Institute here in Salem where they're training people for trades. And these kids that are coming out of there, high school kids that are coming out of there, are actually getting job offers nationally now. So I think there's some real hope if we can see that trend continue. Oregon's land use issue is broken, and it's I should say that I'm a developer also, maybe a recovering developer might be the way to say it, because the difficulty that is there, we all got kind of hung up in that period of time. But when you think about, I was talking with Commissioner Kevin Cameron yesterday at a meeting, and in his work in Marion County, what he's experiencing, he's got the heads of the city saying this 5-year annual review on the supply, it's broken. We can't get through it, period. It's just too hard to do, too hard to accomplish. It doesn't apply in so many of our cases, and we just can't get it done. And we know many cities in Oregon that aren't current on a 5-year supply, probably by at least 10 years sometime. So that plus this non-related or non-interested party or a party without standing ability to block any kind of development that they choose to, even though it's outright permitted. I can share a personal example with you on outright permitted zone property for the master plan, had the streets going through their master plan, water, sewer, everything was there, traffic was there. I fought it for over 3.5 years, cost over $350,000 to fight the thing, and finally ended up selling it to the city of Albany, and the mayor told me, I guess you just bought the wrong property. Now, that's where the brokenness is in this system. I mean, I support urban growth boundaries. I'm an Oregonian. I love the fact that I can drive 15 minutes from the center of most any city and be back in basically the Oregon I grew up in. It's untrue in a few markets, but if you're going to have urban growth boundaries, you have to make it easy for people to develop in it. I'm not saying pave every square inch. None of us believe that, in my opinion. But if you want affordable housing, you have to do it. Because right now, to build a single family 5,000, 6,000 square foot lot is about $45,000 in infrastructure. So with no developer profit, no land cost, no risk factor at all, you got $45,000 out the door right to start with. Then you got to put a home on it at $160 a foot, and that's what's driving affordability. Many communities with income, states with income similar to Oregonians, you could probably get through that same issue and deliver a lot all finished for $45,000, where lots here are going to be $90,000 now. And so some exceptions in that process. Also, financing plays a key part. You know, builders can't get the money that they did in the times that they were really able to start to meet the housing needs. I'm not sure that Oregon can control that. That's basically a federal issue for them. But I do think anything Oregon can do to lobby Congress, and, you know, Dodd-Frank has some very good principles in it, but it also has some that are overly restrictive in the process. So that's kind of an overlook on the market. I think the next thing that we see in Oregon is first-time home buyers. We've got a low percentage of them participating. So you know, Echo Northwest might be able to address it better than I do, but when you think of where most of the job creation is for younger folks, I'd say along the I-5 corridor is where the largest percentage of it is happening, and the metro area is not a place for a young person to buy a home. Currently, our homeownership rate in Oregon is less than 61% compared to a national average of close to 63%. We've always trailed in the time that I've been in the business, so that's since 1985. So Oregon has had a hard time making sure that their citizens have the opportunity to do home ownerships that other states have been able to do. That's part because of our costs that are there. But first-time home buyers right now nationally make up about 44% of the market. In Oregon, they make up 28% of the market. We've got to find a way to help these people that are coming in for a great career to be able to get into a property that they can afford to service. Right now, when you think of the average selling prices in Oregon, the low is out in Baker County, and I mean, there's less population, there's less opportunity, but that's about $154,000, and these are all mean numbers, so takes out the high and the low and gives you the look. The highest is Northwest Washington County, and it's $510,000. Now, it takes a tremendous income to be able to support that kind of purchase, whether you pay cash or whether you finance it. So I think those are issues for us to look at. Across the state, the median is about $285,000. So you've got some numbers that range in that process. Interestingly enough, the real estate industry contributes a lot to the state of Oregon. 17.1% of the gross state product is real estate related. $327,322 million is the number in the process. It's real estate related, and that's not just homeowners. That excludes the homeowners and the gains that they have, because when we sell a home in Oregon, there's $25,200 and change that goes into the economy for that home sale, and that's comprised of the people involved in it. There's another $4,600 that's for appliances to get purchased, drapes and things like that, so it stimulates economy well. And then the typical homeowner right now in Oregon has about an $80,000 gain when they sell their home. So I look at that, and I'll tell you just a story about it. You know, you say $80,000, that's a lot of money. Well, my dad died at the age of 57. I was 28 years old, and I thought, well, hell, that's old, and I'm 65 now, and said, you know. But my parents were lower middle class, and the only thing they had was their home, okay? So my mom was there, and when she started to fail, I was able to sell that home, take that equity and invest it in it, and I paid for her. She never went on any kind of a public assistance role in that process. She had Medicare, so yes, we have had some benefit. But when you think of that, the value of this home ownership does really reduce a burden on state and federal governments when somebody has capital to be able to pay their own way at the end of their life. And I think that's one of the things I believe so strongly in real estate. As a speculation issue, hang on to your hat. But as an investment issue and paying for housing over your head and being able to build something so you can take care of yourself in later years, housing's a great role. Glad to answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you. Sean, do you want to add anything before
Thank
we
you,
open
Mr.
it up for
Chair,
questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I was just going to hit on a couple points, and Representative Peluso heard a few of these yesterday when we presented in Housing and Human Services, but Byron sort of touched on some of the numbers and where we're at. The reality is that purchasing a home is becoming more and more unattainable for Oregonians. And he mentioned the number of the statewide average of $285,000 for the cost of a home. I looked up today, the average cost in Eugene is $280,000, so very similar. In order to purchase that house, if you had no other debt, you would have to make $78,000 a year. That would have to be your family income. If you had student loans and some car payments, which totaled $1,000 a month, you'd have to make $93,000 a year in order to afford that $280,000 house. Our statewide average for median income is $62,000 a year. So we have to do one of two things or both things. We have to make housing more affordable, and we have to raise wages, because we're just meeting a critical mass. And you hear the number about participation by first-time home buyers. It's historically low. Actually, last year was lower. We're at 24% of the market was first-time home buyers. We bumped back up a little bit this year. So there are a number of things, I think, as you all look as policymakers, that we can do going forward. Land use is certainly a big issue. Byron mentioned that we've been behind the national average in home ownership since he's in the business. We've actually been behind since we instituted Senate Bill 100. there are trade-offs. No one is saying that we need to overturn Senate Bill 100, but you have to recognize that there are trade-offs for constraining supply and having a tight artificial barrier. I think the biggest thing that we've looked towards in land use is not eliminating UGBs. It's having a true 20-year buildable supply. The supply that's there needs to actually be able to be developed, absent appeals, areas that were the right places to go. And for the Portland metro region, one of the biggest problems we have is we brought in 12,000 acres is completely unserviceable in the Damascus area. Everyone knew it at the time that it was never going to be developed. Representative Kennemer knows it better than anyone. Representative Bynum knows it as well. There are areas of Damascus that will never be developed. There's no city out there. There was never the ability to service them, and we brought them in. So there are other areas around the state where that's similar too. You must have a true 20-year supply if you're going to be able to build affordable housing. Some of the other numbers around the state, Clackamas County, the average home is $363,000. So in order to do that, you need to make $94,000 a year. Luckily, Portland, you make more money. You make $74,000 as a family of four on average. So you're only $20,000 a year short from reaching that average house. It's a real critical issue that I hope we put more attention to, Mr. Chair. The poster child for our land use system and unaffordability of the city of Ashland. The average house is over $500,000 a year now. I would say that their anti-growth policies have had an impact on why that's the case. With that, Mr. Chair, we're certainly happy to answer any questions. I'll punt it over to Byron for anything technical. And I am surprised, though, that, Mr. Chair, you let a lobbyist sit up at the dais there. I didn't realize we were going to be able to do that. We certainly welcome Representative Hack to our side of the table. And I look forward to sitting next to her in a number of hearings in the years to come.
Thank you, but I am not yet.
So questions? Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I have a question about building and infrastructure. So I'm pro getting more houses. Our seniors are very concerned about not being able to downsize into a house, Clackamas County in specific. But the residents that I talk to are very concerned about us building more without the infrastructure to go with it. So whether that's roads, whether that's schools, what's your proposal to help ease some of those concerns? I think that may be some of the roadblocks that we're running into, people using the system because these other needs aren't met.
Thanks, Representative Bynum. And I would tell you that the solution's probably more education, because when you think of systems development charges that most builders and developers pay to put product in, they range from probably a low in the state now of around $9,000 to a high of over $35,000. So these pay for parks, these pay for roads, these pay for sewer, water. They're all investments that, frankly, most all of us have never paid for ourselves. Okay? We put this in place, and we buy houses that were built often before these came into place. We didn't pay those things. Developers put the roads in. Developers pay off-site expenses, traffic lights, half-street and street improvements, full-street improvements, a mile hookup to sewer or water, those sort of things. Developers fund those. The cities do not. Once they're built, they're dedicated to the city. So it is an investment heavily by ultimately the housing consumer, because those costs have to be passed on. But it's my strong belief that in most communities, system development charges provide, it may not be adequate, but a very strong contribution towards something that most of us as Oregonians have never paid for.
I just follow up real quick, Mr. Chair, and Representative Bynum. You know, you just encouraged me to talk longer when you shut me down. I won't, I promise, Mr. Chair. I think there's two sort of facets to that question. One, the urban infill development, you're always going to have conflicts with existing neighbors. If you choose that policy decision that you want to have urban infill, there's going to be parking issues. There's going to be additional issues there. The second part, though, is the scale of which you're developing in new areas. In other states, and I had the fortune of lobbying in Southern Nevada during the boom years, where we were building massive master plan communities, and literally the scale of the development was such that the developer could actually build all the roads. The developer would even build the schools. They'd put in the hospital, and they could absorb that into the cost of the overall development. Unfortunately, a massive subdivision in Oregon is 20 units. There, I was dealing on a project with 13,000 units. So I think we have one opportunity to see sort of how this will work. It's in South Hillsboro. It's going to be 20,000 units there. It just got approved via action from the legislature in House Bill 4078 and approving the urban growth boundary, because that was under appeal for so many years. But there you'll actually see the developers incorporating in school sites, all the roads, everything will be integrated. And when you have that scale, you can knock down the cost.
Thanks. Well, I appreciate you starting off our hearing today, starting off a little bit about real estate and what's going on. It seems values are up and sometimes unattainable, and that's a big issue. Trying to figure out how to crack that nut is a challenge. So thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, members of the committee.
Up next, Ron Strobel and Paul Cosgrove.
Yeah, we need good money.
Switching a little bit from the front end of real estate to the back end of financing. So thank you for being here and give us a little primer on the trends that you're seeing in the financial industry as it applies.
Great. Thanks for the invitation to participate. My name is Ron Strobel. I'm EVP in charge of home lending at Umpqua Bank. Been there for 15 years. Been in mortgage banking for 40 years, and a native Oregonian, grew up in Pendleton, and have been down in the valley for a number of years. There will be a couple of things that probably I repeat from Byron, but you know, the state of housing finance, 2016, Oregon had $20 billion worth of new loans in residential loans outstanding that we closed throughout the state. 79,000 customers, 10.8 billion were purchases, which was about 52%, 8.7 billion in refinances, or about 43%. And 8.6 million in home improvement. From a statistical standpoint, I won't spend a lot of time on statistics, but there were 6,269 registered mortgage loan officers in Oregon as of December 31, and that was up 3.7% from 2015. The average loans closed per registered MLO, and that could, I think about 50% of those would be people who are processing loans, and 50% are actually originating. The average closed per loan officer was 12 loans per year. So a very fragmented, widespread number of loan officers throughout the state. Umpqua Bank listed as the number three largest lender in Oregon. Two of the top five lenders were banks. Three were independent mortgage companies supporting both the retail and correspondent channel. They may be outside the state. They originate the loans in the state, and they close it and fund it outside the state and take it into the secondary markets. Just a comparison between 2016 and what we think will be the end of 2017. Umpqua in Oregon closed $1.9 billion in 2016, 68% purchase, 32% refinance. This year, we estimate about 1.82, 75% purchase and 25% refi. That downward momentum is basically 4% in a total volume year over year as a function of rates in the market going higher than when it's beneficial for somebody to refinance. So you saw an increase in the amount of purchase business. As mentioned earlier, we do participate in a program since I've been with Umpqua 15 years, a single close construction program designed to help borrowers specifically finance the construction piece of it. It's been a very successful program. It's not speculative. It's to somebody who wants to build their house. And it's been proven the last couple of years as a big growth factor in our business and a big benefit to customers throughout the state. In addition to that, we have a lot of low to moderate income programs. We have some innovative programs. One of them was just released in Washington. We can't do it in Oregon, but it was a condo deal. But we're always constantly looking for things that we can do both in the urban and rural markets. Borrowers' options for mortgage loans, and I think this is really where you're wanting to know, I think is very strong in the Oregon market. We're not back in 2005 or 7 or 10 or 11 when, you know, we saw the subprime debacle, but I think the product and programs that are available to those who qualify and they are best suited to be successful with home ownership. Consumers nationally report that it's much easier to find a mortgage today than it was just a few years ago. And to Byron's, another thing I threw in here is the ratio nationally of existing sales to new home sales remains totally out of balance. In 2010, that ratio was 15.5 existing sales to one new home sale. Today, that's 7.3-1. I think those numbers probably speak very well for Oregon as well as nationally as well. Next point is challenges facing borrowers in Oregon. And this is where we probably agree. The supply of affordable homes throughout the state continues to be very low. You know, the big questions in many markets today are what state local planners agencies are doing about affordable housing. What about the expansion of the urban growth boundary? And then the question I had to deal with in a similar situation up in Washington a year ago. Planners are wanting to go vertical, high density versus horizontal. And the question that I have is, what do consumers want? And what we're seeing is that trend back into, you know, wanting to go horizontal, which means a push towards the urban growth boundary and so on. Unemployment continues to be very low, attracting many new jobs here in Oregon. They want to become homeowners, and many of them come from outside states, and they bring money with them. So, again, competition for existing folks in Oregon with the income that was talked about earlier being as low as it is, people are coming in with down payments, they're coming in with money in the bank, and so they are gobbling up some of our housing stock. Home values continue to escalate beyond a lot of income means, and I would say it's not just first-time home buyers. I think it's second-time home buyers of Oregonians, people who have lived here for a long time. It's just not first-time home buyers. I mean, and it's not going to change. I mean, there's the desirability of the West Coast, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, L.A., San Diego. It's the whole West Coast. This is not just a phenomenon in Portland. Cash transactions still represent a significant amount of sales. And I would say, and probably even for Baker, I think demand for housing is generally strong throughout the state. But very high demand is apparent in many locations to specific neighborhoods, school districts, and transportation options that are that affect the quality of life. There will be those pockets that people have a high preference to get into. Challenges that we face, regulatory requirements are really tough to manage for all lenders. The associated costs of those regulations get passed on to the borrowers. It is truly a pass-through to the borrowers. Right now, our industry is focused on technology. We're trying to spend as much as we can to not only help lower the cost, but also to improve the experience working with Fannie, Freddie, on things that I think are helping reduce the time frame and the ease in which to get a loan. And I think that's going to continue. The new disclosure requirements that took effect in 2016 were very difficult for a lot of lenders, and that came right out of Dodd-Frank. Servicing rules under Dodd-Frank continue to pressure lenders on what the state and local, as well as the state and local officials, have put into law the specific requirements on what lender or what has to happen to houses once they are vacated. Trying to manage to the state-specific or city-specific rules and guidelines, it makes it very, very difficult. And it's not just for Oregon. We manage 5-6 different states, and keeping up with all the local and state requirements is very difficult. New HMDA requirements, you're going to hear a lot about that. There's something like 40 more fields of government monitoring information that will be required when making a loan application. It's going to confuse the borrowers on why you have to provide it. It's going to add time and effort to the things that we have to do. But that goes into effect in 2018. This is one of the things I think is probably very interesting for you. I mean, our responsibility as a bank and a community lender is the CRA, Community Reinvestment Act. And for the last 5 years, I have had to defend, our originations of loans to low to moderate income borrowers. And that has continued as a percentage of our total volume go down, down, down. We constantly look at what our peers are doing. We still continue to exceed our peers, but that percentage to low to moderate income borrowers is going down and down and down. And the agencies are trying to come up with ideas. One of the things that they are kicking around right now that may be of interest to you is they're looking at Fannie and Freddie, or Fannie is looking at financing mobile home as chattel and making that available in the secondary market. So that is going to have a good impact on Oregon if that were to happen. I'm not sure which lenders will participate in that, but something new on the horizon. Lastly, challenges facing the mortgage market in Oregon. Again, I believe there are plenty of options available to qualified borrowers throughout the state. As for housing supply, I will break it into three categories, what I think the markets are. And I think it supports the earlier presentation. There's the upper end in any market, whether you're in Baker or you're in Portland or you're in Roseburg. There's three different there's the upper market in those. There's the middle, and then there's the lower end. And the upper end, I think the higher price housing in any market is pretty much in balance. I think it's healthy. The middle market, I would say the upper middle market price range, especially in the urban areas, what I see is builders have built in that marketplace, and a lot of that building is in the urban areas, and there's a lot of houses coming available in that space. And so I think you might see some adjustments over the winter on trying to move those houses, and that demand, that supply might be a little bit more than the demand of what people can afford. The lower end of the middle size in the market, I think, is in balance, but the low end of the market, and I don't mean this in a negative, but if you break it up into high, medium, and low, but the lower range, depending on where you're at, there's just no supply. And, people are discouraged, borrowers are discouraged, because the multiple offers that they have to make on houses to try and get a house is just, it's self-defeating. Jobs, obviously, a primary driver of housing is solid, low unemployment, and tax reform. The tax reform bill, what will be, I don't have the answer to this, but it's a question that everybody's going to have to really pay attention to, because what is going to happen to the potential elimination of the state income tax deduction to borrowers and the limitation of property tax deduction, in particular for Oregonians? our income tax structure, our tax property tax deduction. Given the current proposal, I believe that this is going to have an impact, and I don't know how much or when, but it will have an impact on home values in general in Oregon, given the way it's presented right now. I want to thank you for the time, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions that you guys might have.
Yeah, we're sort of running tight on a schedule. We'll let Paul, and then we'll have a quick question or two.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Bankers Association, of which Umpqua is one of our very good members. Just one point. Ms. Trouble talked a lot about federal regulation and federal tax issues. I just want to concentrate on one particular state issue, which is within the bailiwick of you all as our representatives. Over the last couple of years, there have been a couple of lawsuits. We're still involved in one. One was settled early on, brought by entities that assert that financial institutions who are using a system that is required by Fannie and Freddie for electronic recording of certain mortgage records. Fannie and Freddie require their lenders to do that, and over 60% of all home loans in Oregon are Fannie and Freddie, so most of the loans are in this system, that those should have been recorded in the county, and therefore the lawsuit is for $50 million for recording fees for documents never recorded, never presented for recording. That's obviously had a real chilling effect. It's had a specific chilling effect on community banks. And a number of our members who have been in the mortgage market are no longer in the mortgage market. They were named in the first suit. Some of them are named in the second suit. The suit names big banks and little banks. And we need to see if we can find a solution to that problem, because it's reducing the availability of options to consumers, to your residents. Community banks are an important part of the mortgage market. They've always been, and they need to be an important part of the mortgage market. And if this lawsuit is chilling that part of the market, it's not good for consumers. It's not good for the banking industry. It's not good for the home building industry. It's just not good for Oregonians. So that's an issue. We started to discuss that last year, and we think we'll be discussing that when we all see you back in February as well. So thank you very much. Happy to answer any questions as well.
All right. Representative Doherty.
Yeah, the gentleman from UNCLA, I have a question about the upward. Is there an upward trend in Oregon? I know there is in the state of Washington for out-of-country cash buyers of homes, especially on the higher end. Are you seeing more of a trend of that in Oregon or not?
Just to make sure I understand, out of country, foreigners coming in and buying property. Yeah, we are.
Cash basis.
Yeah, on a cash basis, we are. We're seeing a lot of folks coming from Vancouver, BC, mm-hmm. Right down through Seattle, right into Portland.
Right.
Now, we don't, you know, and sometimes we will finance that. It's not all cash.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. Just a quick question. Earlier you mentioned ongoing tax reform efforts potentially impacting the mortgage deduction and the property tax deduction. And I know nationally mortgage companies as well as realtors have been opposed to those pieces of the tax reform. What I'm hoping you can add to your list of being opposed to and grow awareness of is that in the latest iteration in the House, it gets rid of QVMBs. Qualified Veteran Mortgage Bonds, which would effectively kill the Oregon Veterans Home Program that we currently have that have allowed 340,000 veterans. So what's going on right now is that the tax reform process, you can think what you will about what the process is going to produce, but the end result, if it continues as crafted, will eliminate the ability of vets to actually use that as a tool, which will probably impact the rest of your market, but it will certainly impact the vets. So in your communications with folks across the nation and the state, if you could add that to the list of what shouldn't be touched, we'd really appreciate it.
Will do. Thank you.
Last question, Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you. Going back, you discussed upper, middle, and lower, but you didn't put a cost number. What? And they're remarkably different in different zones.
Yeah, I do that as a way of understanding Portland prices are way different than prices in Pendleton, or Ben's prices are different than Roseburg's prices. And so I do that. Each market has a high, medium, and low. And so, therefore, I kind of identify the markets, what's in balance, what's out of balance, or what's, totally out of supply. But so I don't put a dollar amount on it. I mean, if you needed to put a dollar amount, I mean, I could tell you in Portland that, anything over $1 million is pretty much in balance. Anything between 500 and a million, the upper end, that's 700 to a million, that's the market I would say is got a lot of supply in it. But 500 to 700, I think that's probably in balance, and then anything under 500 is out of balance. If you could do the same thing in Bend or Roseburg, that's the logic behind that.
Chair, follow up. I'll make it quick. Approximately what percentage of the market is upper, middle, and lower in terms of units? Do you know that?
Most of our, we do about 25% of our business is portfolio. So I would say for us about 25% would be above conforming limits of Fannie and Freddie. And I think if you were to break it down by marketplace, that probably would be 30 to 35% in Portland, and then lower as you go out from there.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate you making the effort to be here and give us a little snapshot of the financial industry, and always food for thought.
Great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If we could get Pam Levitt and Gregory Schumacher.
Good afternoon, everyone. Pam Levitt with the Northwest Credit Union Association. I think the testimony from the lenders is very has a lot of numbers in it. So we have a lot of numbers in our testimony, but I wanted to let you know that ours is on OLIS if you want to take a look at it, because there's a lot of data in there. The foreclosure crisis and resulting recession revealed a broken housing market with home loan products that were hard for most consumers to understand. As not-for-profit financial institutions, credit unions focused on our members, and we offered during the recession simple and straightforward and products, home loan products with reasonable interest rates. In January of 2010, about 3.5% of homeowners in Oregon were 90 days or more behind in their mortgages. And at that time, delinquency in Oregon credit unions was about 1.75%. Today, the 90-day delinquency rate at Oregon Credit Union stand at 0.25%, and foreclosures are almost unheard of right now. Housing must be accessible to all people in all income levels. We have, if you don't know, 39 of our 59 credit unions in Oregon are designated by the federal government as low income designation, meaning they primarily serve members that make up 80% or more of the medium household income. We have on our books, those credit unions, nearly $700 million in 30-year fixed mortgages during the first half of 2017. And Oregon Credit Unions provided over 3,000 families with 30-year fixed rate home loans, averaging about $240,000. So right now, our average interest rate on a first-year mortgage loan portfolio at an Oregon Credit Union is 4.02%, which is a number that's been fairly stable for many years. We all need to to jump in and have creative solutions, innovative solutions to the affordable housing crisis. I know Oregon Credit Unions are looking at financing for things like tiny homes, micro communities, cooperative housing programs, and first-time home buyer programs. We are certainly working to serve our individuals who qualify for home loans and those who need additional financial education prior to accessing a home loan. So more than myself, I thought I'd bring one of the largest credit unions in Oregon to talk really about what's going on in his credit union and give you a snapshot.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for having me. My name is Greg Schumacher. I'm the Chief Administrative Officer at Oregon Community Credit Union. We're headquartered in Eugene, Oregon. We serve roughly 150,000 members in 28 counties in the state. I also serve as the Chief Financial Officer and the General Counsel for the organization. I'm here on their behalf, not as a lender, to talk about the challenges that we're facing. OCCU, or Oregon Community, is poised to lend to borrowers. We are a low-income designated organization, and we are poised to lend to those members. Unfortunately, many of those members cannot afford mortgages because of the shortage of the housing inventories. They've been priced out of the ability to fund a mortgage. And we're there for them. We, as I said, we're a low-income designated financial institution. We make hundreds of millions of dollars in loans, in mortgage loans every year, thousands to members. But those folks at the low end of the spectrum are not part of that group because they simply can't qualify. This, despite our best efforts with respect to some of the remedial efforts that we put into place to help and protect and safeguard the low-income members from financial stress if they were to get into it. For example, we have less than 5 foreclosures a year. We are not an organization that lends to members that can't afford to maintain those mortgages. And when they do get in trouble, we don't offer judicial foreclosure in most cases. We offer a deed in lieu. We don't collect on a deficiency balance following a deed in lieu. And then we'll help transition those members to another residence where we can. And so we have loan counselors available. We have for 20 years. We have 2 full-time counselors that do nothing but try to help folks in distress work through the problem so that they can maintain and save their homes and their autos. But unfortunately, the housing crisis and the lack of availability of affordable housing has pushed many of our members outside of the home ownership dream. Until we can address the housing shortage and the affordability issues, as well as some of them, it's been mentioned by the folks from the other financial institutions, the regulations and the secondary market restrictions that make lending to those folks even more difficult because those loans aren't able to be put into the secondary market. It makes them less fluid. It makes them less attractive to those who might otherwise invest in those. And therefore, it makes the origination of those products difficult for us to do. So I didn't want to take up a whole lot of time. I just wanted to say thank you again and know that in Eugene and Springfield, we serve our members, 150,000 plus. We want to put them in homes. We strive to put them in homes, but we're not able to, and it really bothers us. We have a very strong effort to try to enhance home ownership and our mortgage loan portfolio, and we're not able to do so in the numbers we'd like to because of those factors. Our home ownership, our delinquency is 0.01%. I think Pam mentioned 25 basis points for most financial institutions. We're well below that. We have some $200 million in our loan portfolio mortgages. I think we have 19,000 delinquent 90 days or more. So the products are there. The institutions that are willing to lend to those folks are there. We're one of them. But the economics of the situation make it very, very difficult, even when that desire is present. And so I urge you to consider that as you think about some of the things that we can do in the state to help those folks.
Thank you. I do appreciate it. I mean, the theme seems to be that we don't have the supply and the values of homes are outpacing the income levels of getting people into homes. And I'm sure it takes a balancing sort of look at this. As much as you would like to put people in homes, you know, they do need to have the ability to pay to keep us out of, you know, the next foreclosure crisis.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, the ability to pay is an important regulation. It can be burdensome. It's very onerous in terms of administration. And it's there to protect members. And we're not going to put a member in a product they can't afford. But as I said earlier, there just isn't enough inventory for affordability for many of our members in that situation.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate you being here. Well, we'll move a little bit more on financial industry, but more from a regulatory aspect. So we'll call up Richard Blackwell, and Cheryl, if you want to come up or wait till he's done, you can do either one.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rick Blackwell. I'm the policy manager for the Division of Financial Regulation within DCBS. Just going to give you a brief update today, given time, on the regulation of the financial industry. So for my update today, I'm just going to go through a brief background on the types of entities that are lending to Oregonians, some of the data on employment, but by which I mean the licensed folks that are doing the work, and give you at least some pictures of the lending activity. I know you've got some of that, so it'll largely corroborate with the gentleman from Umpqua. Talk about some examination trends in mortgage lending. So we actually do examine the folks that are for compliance matters that are making these loans. I can talk generally about that. And then recent legal developments. I'll cover Oregon's recent servicing law that was passed in the 2017 long session. So you've heard from our state chartered banks and credit unions who within their powers are able to make mortgage loans. So we examine banks and credit unions on a safety and soundness basis. We're watching the overall financial picture of the institution. Other entities that actually do lend as well are mortgage bankers and mortgage brokers. Brokers are essentially arranging a transaction between some kind of lending source, like a wholesale lender, and the consumer, the borrower, and then step away from the transaction. A mortgage banker, on the other hand, will use their own resources to fund the mortgage. And since 2009, after the passage of the Safe Mortgage Licensing Act by the federal government, all 50 states have actually licensed the activities of the individuals that either make a mortgage loan or will negotiate the terms of the mortgage loan. So those are the individuals that you primarily interface with when you're getting your mortgage loan. And then I should mention that, federally chartered institutions are obviously lending in the state. We're preempted for the most part by the National Bank Act and associated regulations that are promulgated by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, but they are a major player in the Oregon market. In terms of numbers for licenses, there are about 11,000 licensees that have the authorization from us, from DCBS, to make mortgage loans. This would be both the mortgage loan originators working for brokers or bankers or consumer finance lenders. Out of those, only 2,000 are actually based in Oregon. So because this is a license that is required by all 50 states, typically a person might be licensed in multiple states in case they have to make a mortgage loan across another jurisdiction. As the gentleman from Umpqua mentioned, there's about 6,000 federally registered loan originators. So the SAFE Act created a framework where states would license people within their jurisdictions, and then the financial institutions would register their folks in the same system. So everyone uses the same system, but there are basically two paths to regulation. So we have about 6,000 originators that are working essentially for a bank or a federally or state chartered bank or credit union. And then about 755 mortgage companies. So these are the brokers or bankers that I mentioned earlier. We get data from, let me take a step back. Part of what the SAFE Act did in 2009 was establish or encourage the states to establish a registry to aggregate and to help facilitate the flow of information among regulators. So as part of that, the entity is called the National Mortgage Licensing System and Registry, or NMLS, created a mortgage call report. And since 2012, we've been receiving data from both our licensed entities, the ones I mentioned before, and also federally registered folks also input data into the system. So we do have about 5 years of data now from this effort. So we can see some trends in loan purpose. So for starters, most loans in Oregon are the majority are purchase or refinance, few home improvement loans. I'm not entirely sure why the home improvement's so low. I suspect it's probably because it's connected to whether it's tied to the real property or not. In any event, you'll also notice in this chart, though, that nationwide, we're pretty close to the nationwide data that is being received by the same registry. I think you'll notice in a lot of the charts as we go through that really Oregon is not typically, is not special, you know, compared to other states in the nation. So in terms of the number of MLOs making loans, you can see from the beginning of 2012, we've had a steady increase from the folks that are both licensed and also reporting that they've made at least one loan into the registry, from about a low of 2,000 to a high of about 4,500 in Oregon. And the trend is fairly similar when you look at the nationwide data. Forward loan types. So again, we you've heard some testimony already about FHA programs or veterans. For the most part, conventional loans are what is being sold in Oregon, so three quarters about. The veterans loans are about 10% of the market. And then FHA insured, which are more onerous in terms of what you have to do to get the loan, but are guaranteed by the Federal Housing Association or Administration, about 15% of the market. And then FSA, RHS are USDA rural loans. So, and as you can tell, nationwide, we're tracking pretty close. So nothing really to report there. In terms of forward loan amounts, you can see the progression from 2012. We have this data is actually the number of the amount of loans that were made in a calendar quarter. And so while there are dips, I think the general trend seems to be, you can see that the amounts of loans in Oregon are steadily increasing in amount. So this is, I think this bears what you've heard previously from the other panels, that lending is increasing. And nationwide, again, we are really, I would say, not very special. I think this is really a national trend that you're seeing. Forward loan count. So last one was dollar amount. This is just the number of loans that are made. Again, I think you can see the trend that we are seeing increasing amounts of activity from 2012. So examinations. Part of what we do in both for the brokers, bankers, and also consumer finance lenders is examine them for compliance with various laws, and both federal and state laws. So I asked our examiners kind of what are the things that you are seeing when you go out in the field, and what are the things that you are working with these folks, with the licensees, to improve upon, or if we have to go to enforcement on, though. Primarily, what we try to do is to make sure that the folks are complying with the law and moving forward that instead. A lot of ones are actually failing to file these data reports, which I've actually derived all this information for you. Referral agreements. So sometimes we've seen entities that set up an advertising or marketing agreement, but it's structured more as compensation. This is something that the CFPB had issued guidance on in 2015. We have seen the trends, though, decrease as a result of the guidance. Failing to document certain compensation plans or not getting the application signed by the MLO and the borrower, very important to have signature on a contract. And because primarily the structure of regulation of the businesses are that branch managers or offices are managed by someone that's responsible and are watching what's going on with the employees. We want to be able to see that the plans for making sure that those supervisory plans are adequate. So we have noted that in the exam reports. So this year, this legislature passed, well, or I guess the 2017 long session, we had proposed and was passed Senate Bill 98, which actually requires the largest non-depository loan servicers to obtain a license with us. We're primarily looking for both making sure the folks are licensed, that they are solvent and able to keep their operations going, because I think disruption by a loan servicer would cause great problems in the mortgage market for everyone, whether you're paying on time or not. And then also giving us a framework to work with other states to make sure that these entities, which are really multi-state operations, continue to adhere to the law. So we adopted some temporary rules this year to make sure that they could get onto the NMLS system for licensing. But we're going to work with stakeholders to make those rules permanent in 2018. And we already have 19 applications. So I know that I was trying to be brief, so if there's any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Thank you. Appreciate your walk through the regulatory structure, and as far as enforcement actions in the financial industry, do you see trends in that? Is it pretty static, or, you know, is it fewer, more?
Well, Chair Holvey, so typically Great Recession, I think we saw our business is countercyclical. I guess I'll put it that way. The more problems there are, I think, in the economy, the more we get complaints. There are some very legitimate and valid concerns that we need to address, sometimes through enforcement. As things have improved, we get less complaints. And so that's really, while I didn't include any data on that, anecdotally, we do receive less complaints in good times.
Sort of like unemployment insurance. Well, I appreciate Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. One question, if I might. How much movement have we seen from banks going from a federal charter to a state charter here in Oregon over the last years?
Chair Holvey and Representative Wilson. Primarily what you see in banking is consolidation. So a lot of times what I've noticed is that state chartered entities will either merge. You will see mergers across state lines, so you may have a Washington or an Idaho bank purchase an Oregon bank or vice versa. The trend is definitely consolidation, but as far as switching charters, that's not really been the case.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Rick.
Thank you.
Cheryl?
Sure. Okay. I guess we're swapping a minute. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm the Deputy Legislative Director at the Oregon Department of Justice, and I was asked to come and present on the Oregon Foreclosure Avoidance Program. So this is a program that was put into place, started in 2012 and then sort of refined in 2013 during the foreclosure crisis. Just a quick note, I'll kind of explain what the program did, how it came about, and three very short stories and then some stats as well. I know you've had a numbers-heavy presentation today, so I'll try to keep that one quick. First of all, though, I'll mention, the foreclosure crisis was a crisis. Thankfully, we don't have the headlines today that we had then, but, we had mortgage-backed securities and we had a lot of robo-signing, scams going on, that kind of thing. Your Department of Justice took a lot of action involving national actions with other attorneys general against a lot of the big financial institutions. We got $30 million to the state of Oregon, which helped fund the Oregon Foreclosure Avoidance Program. A little bit of that money went to basically be the seed money for this program. We went after, like I said, robo-signing companies and some local scam artists as well. It seems like every time there's a crisis, there's scam artists right alongside of it. We went so far even as to do some criminal prosecution for people who were doing loan modifications, and basically just it was out and out theft. So that was sort of the bigger picture of the foreclosure crisis. One of the big things we did with, of course, a lot of help from you was the program itself. We sat down with stakeholders, and one of the biggest issues we kept hearing was, the lenders aren't listening. The homeowners would say, the lenders aren't listening to me. I don't know what paperwork to put in. I'm just very confused. For a lot of folks, your home is the most complex financial transaction you'll do in your lifetime. And so we talked with folks and came up with a plan to basically, I'll say, provide a table and provide a filing cabinet. And that was the program. What the program required was for lenders to foreclose, they needed to go through a mediation process, a alternative dispute resolution with the homeowner. It required them to do that before they could move on with the foreclosure. Before we passed, you passed the 2013 bill, the lenders were not responding to homeowner requests for mediation 83% of the time. Obviously now when they've had to engage, that number's a lot better. But So the program came into place, and like I said, in 2013. It required folks to come to the table. In the statute, in the law itself, it directed the Department of Justice to hire a subcontractor. We hired Mediation Case Manager is the name of that program. And the program got going. So what does the program do? Like I said, it's a table and it's a filing cabinet. The filing cabinet obviously isn't a real filing cabinet somewhere, but it's an online portal. And what happens with that is the lenders submit their documents, the homeowners submit their documents, and so it's all in one place. A lot of confusion was happening over, well, I sent this document last week. Did you get it yet? No. Well, you haven't sent it yet. You know, that confusion that can happen in a bureaucracy or a large company. We tried to kind of pare that down to have one place where that all sat. And a big part of getting all of that straight is the housing counselors. So there's basically four people at the table in these dispute resolution conferences. There's the homeowner, there's the lender, there's the mediator, and then a lot of times there's also the housing counselor. The housing counselors are funded through a separate program, but they're just very important to the process. They're the ones that really help get the homeowner organized, help get the right paperwork in place. We've even heard from the lenders, you know, that's just really helpful to just have the documents there so they can actually have a real discussion when they get to the table. Unfortunately, the housing counselors, it was a rough session money-wise, and some of their funding, I think, got cut in this last session, so they're going to be stretched thin. I know some of the housing counselor agencies have already shut down in more rural areas of the state, so that's going to have an effect on the program, unfortunately, in a not-so-great way. But we will continue. So the program, like I said, provides a neutral place, and we'll go through some stats in a minute. The results, and we'll go through those stats, but a lot of people have been able to keep their homes. Some have, I would say, come to understand their situation and being able to retain their homes, saved a lot of emotional and financial energy, and were able to come and say, you know what, let's just go and do a deed in lieu of foreclosure or short sale, something like that. So just a few brief stories from real people in the program. One couple had previously received a permanent modification, but the lender never fully processed it. They were trying to stop the foreclosure, couldn't do it, finally went through the program and discovered the lender, there was a computer glitch. And so they were able to fix that glitch, and the homeowners were able to keep their home. Another fairly typical story, family with three kids. Dad gets laid off, finds a job pretty quickly. They, even before the program, come to a loan modification. They make all the trial payments to on their end. But then the lender kind of started backing out of that agreement, went to the foreclosure mediation table, and they were able to keep the original terms. One more example, in-home daycare provider. So this is not only her home, it's her business. She continued to have steady income through her daycare, had some medical expenses, got behind on her mortgage. The threat of foreclosure was very real. They went through the program and, oh, actually you are bringing in income from your daycare. This is a, you know, you probably can't sustain these payments, and we're able to negotiate, and she was able to stay in her home. So those are just some stories of folks that have been through. And I'll go through the stats. So first off, it's kind of small, but it gives you a picture of the intake that we've had through the program from its inception in August of 2013. As you can see, it peaked in about spring of 2014. And it's actually stayed fairly steady in the last 2 years. There's sort of a zooming in of those numbers. It's staying pretty much in the 400 to 500 range. How the program is funded is actually through fees. There's no general fund dollars. The fees are paid by both the lender and the homeowner chips in as well. So we're able to sustain it. when we put the bill in place, we looked at, okay, what number do we need to be at to sustain this program? That number was 200. That's contemplated in the contract with our subcontractor. And so you can see we're staying double that at the moment. So I think this is a program, even though we're seeing an uptick in prices and everything, this is a program that's still helping a lot of folks and doing a lot of good and sustainable. Here is the progress and participation stats. So we've notified almost 40,000 folks through the program. About 700 are still open. Some of the cases were closed even before the homeowner paid the fee. Either the bank and the homeowner were able to come to an agreement before the mediation began, or for other reasons. So the request for withdrawal of the 1100 number there is where they were able to come to an agreement. Participating homeowners, 8,767 have paid the fee. Adjusted participation rate, so this is about 31% of people who are notified actually participate in the program, pay the fee. Adjusted means we just took out people who like were deceased or there was no successor in interest, that kind of thing, where there was an actual person, a homeowner there. Sometimes what happens is they go through the have a meeting, but for some reason the paperwork requirements from the lender weren't complied with. One of the requirements is the lender must have somebody with actual decision-making authority at the table. We had some issues with getting the actual person in the seat there. And so when that happens, a certificate of notices of no certificate are issued, meaning they've got to go back and go through the program again before they can go through with the foreclosure process. And that was in about 1,000 cases. And sometimes they're able to come to an agreement and a mutual agreement to cancel as it happens. What are the outcomes when the mediation does happen? An agreement was reached where the homeowner got to retain their home in about 3,000 cases. And that can be anything from a permanent loan modification to a payoff to repayment, reinstatement, or even forbearance, just depending on the situation. An agreement was reached for non-retention, meaning cash for keys or a traditional sale or a deed in lieu of foreclosure, any number of options there. And sometimes it's a pre-conference agreement that that folks are able to come to even before the mediation. An agreement was not reached in about half the cases. Sometimes the homeowner didn't appear, and sometimes they just couldn't come to terms, which happens as well. There's a voluntary survey at the end of the whole process that our subcontractor does, and these are the satisfaction rates with the program itself. They have metrics on communications from all the other parties, accuracy, and so forth. So wanted to keep it short and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Cheryl. Just one question. It's when I'm looking at the monthly case intake into the program, as you were mentioning, it's been pretty consistent for the last couple of years, it looks like. So do you have information or to surmise, I guess, whether this is the norm going forward, or is this still some of the tail end of the foreclosure crisis and it's just taken a while for those foreclosures to get through the process?
Chair Holvey, I would say maybe the banks would also have the lenders would have an idea on that too. Just informally talking with a few folks, some of it is these are foreclosures that are maybe a little bit more complicated than were at the beginning of the foreclosure crisis. So they've been waiting on these a little bit, even though they may be stemming from the crisis itself. But to give a real answer, I think we need more information.
Okay, well, I'll follow up with that question offline to some of the others that participated. Any other questions for Cheryl? Well, Cheryl, thank you very much for making the effort to be here. Good luck in the very near future.
Thank you.
I hope you have a happy new year.
We will try.
Well, that sort of wraps up the presentation on real estate, mortgage trends, and foreclosure, and where we're at today. I just thought it would be interesting for us to hear from the industry. And it sounds like we do have some real challenges ahead. So people don't make enough money, it seems, to qualify sometimes. So let's next bring up Nick Belichick to talk about labor trends. Okay, Nick, do what you can to keep us moving.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Nick Belichick. I'm the state employment economist for the Oregon Employment Department's Workforce and Economic Research Division, which provides accurate, reliable, and timely information about statewide and local labor market conditions. And Oregon's labor market is really good right now. We have very good job growth. Businesses have a lot of vacancies that are going unfilled, and employment is at record lows, creating labor shortages. It's been like this for a year or two. I've been telling about the situation over and over again. It sort of started to rhyme. I was saying it so much. So I actually wrote a economy rhyme, if you will, to describe the situation. It goes like this. Oregon's economy, growing berserkers. Employers have jobs, but where are the workers?
Clever.
Beautiful. Stick to employment.
Chair Holby, I appreciate the advice. The rest of my presentation kind of follows this theme, though. The economy is growing berserkers. In fact, in October, we had a near-record month of growth with 11,600 jobs added. That followed 2 months of job losses. There's a lot of volatility in the month-to-month figures recently. These are estimates produced by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics based on a survey of employers. And they get benchmarked and revised as more information comes in from employers. When we look past the last couple of months of volatility, though, the overall job growth is looking really good. The average number of jobs added this year is 3,800 jobs per month. That's a little bit slower than 2014 and 2015. But we're kind of thinking, you know, this could have to do with unemployment rate dropping so low, there aren't as many workers, you know, ready to jump in and take these jobs when they become available. We've added 45,000 jobs over the last 12 months for an annual job growth rate of 2.4%. And that's pretty good. This graph, instead of looking at the month-to-month change, this is a 12-month rate of change going back to the recession. So you can see the job losses earlier and the job growth since around 2010 when we started turning the corner. Oregon is actually adding jobs faster than the nation now, and we have since about 2013. So we've been adding jobs at a good clip for a number of years now. The U.S. over the last 12 months added jobs at 1.4% rate. So we're looking at 2.4% rate, which is actually up there in terms of the top growth among states. For a number of months, we have reached that point where Oregon had the fastest job growth in a 12-month period. And I don't know, it's too early to call October because although we had our release yesterday, the rest of the states aren't published until Friday. So we'll know for sure where we rank in terms of how fast we are among other states. So there's probably some people thinking, yeah, Nick, we may be adding a lot of jobs, but they're all low-wage jobs, right? Mm-mm. And I don't think that's true. Oregon's adding low, medium, and high-paying jobs. Three out of the four jobs added over the last 12 months were in industries that pay higher, that had average wages that were higher than the overall average wage. So if that makes sense, about three-fourths of the growth over the last year were in kind of higher than average wage industries. And so that's what this graph is showing. The green bars show the growth, number of jobs added over the last 12 months. The red bars show industries that lost jobs over the last 12 months. And you have the detail there, if you can see it. I'll point out the construction industry, which really, once construction started adding jobs, that was kind of the last remaining piece of the puzzle to really help Oregon become a fast-growing state in terms of number of jobs. In the last 12 months, construction added 9,400 jobs for a growth rate of 10.3%. And now it's just shy of reaching its pre-recession peak of jobs. Couple of the industries that stand out there for being in the red over the last year, federal government is not a growing area. There were losses earlier in the recession related to postal services that have kind of evened out now. Those aren't occurring, but the rest of federal seems to be losing just a couple hundred jobs over the last year. Mining and logging, that's in the red, although this recent drop had to do with reorganizing some employment into another industry. So until that works its way through the system, it's not a loss of jobs, it's a movement into another kind of technical thing. I like to get into this, but don't worry about the mining and logging red that you see right there. And other services, that red has to do with marijuana jobs, because dispensaries were classified as membership organizations. You had to be a member in order to purchase, but now that they've moved to regular retail, those jobs have been switched over. So we see red in other services, but some of the green in retail trade is picking up those jobs. So overall, really broad-based growth in terms of industries. And that's filtering out to the average wages. So here I have the annual average private sector hourly wage adjusted for inflation over time. So if you're thinking, you know, I've heard the story that wages aren't rising, that was true certainly following the recession, but since around 2015, there's been enough job growth, enough demand, a low enough unemployment rate, and low enough rate of inflation that we're seeing real job growth here, or real wage growth here. Oregon looks better than the U.S. in this respect. But one thing fitting with the theme of the housing presentations we heard earlier, I'm adjusting for inflation based on U.S. average inflation for a technical reason. But if I kind of cross-check this with Portland area inflation, which is seeing housing prices increase faster than the U.S., this doesn't look as good, but it's still positive. So it's kind of fitting with the theme that they're talking about earlier. All regions of the state are adding jobs. One of the handouts that I think you have, I hope you have a table that shows the county job growth through September for all areas if you want to look at your area. But region-wise, all areas are seeing growth in the 12 months through September. And although some areas are looking like slower growth, one thing that this sort of analysis doesn't pick up is the number of replacement openings caused by the workforce aging, people retiring, leaving their occupation, creating an opportunity for a new worker to find a job in that area. That doesn't show up as growth, but there are more opportunities, I think, in a lot of these areas than is really represented by the overall growth. So if that makes sense, this is showing new jobs due to growth in the economy, but there's also replacement openings and opportunities being created by the aging of the workforce. Of course, the landscape of jobs, the types of industries we've seen change over time, and this is kind of a neat way to show it. The next slide will show, or this graph shows different industries, and the next slide is going to show a move over the time from 1991 to the present. And so when you see the industry shift to the right, that's an industry that's growing a share of total employment. When you see these bubbles representing industry shift up, then that's an industry that's growing in average monthly wages. So Makes sense. Labels will pop up there in a minute. They're all clustered around an average wage of $3,500 in current dollars, but they're going to spread out as the economy changes in the last 25 years.
Cool.
So you can see computer and electronic product manufacturing increasing in wages over time, although it's a slightly smaller portion of the overall economy. That's one that stands out. Food services and drinking places moving to the right, so it's growing as a share of the economy, but it's not increasing in average wages adjusted for inflation. Up there, that pops up. See that gray bubble is wood product manufacturing, which decreased as a share of the overall economy, but average wages stayed about the same. So we certainly know the story of fewer wood product manufacturing jobs relative to the rest of the economy. But if you also notice during the change that overall there is professional scientific and technical services, that pink bubble, ambulatory health care services, which like doctor's offices, the orange bubble, and administrative and support services, those all increased as share of the economy and also increased in average wages. So I'll play that just one more time if you found the industry you wanted to track. Although some industries have shrunk relative to their size in Oregon's economy 25 years ago, other industries and industries that are seeing, you know, higher paying wages have grown as a share of the economy. So, and it's kind of a neat way to demonstrate that. That's just 10 industries at a detail, or there's about 70 other industries that we could look at. I think these are all ones that sort of are illustrated and we know about and are good examples. So minimum wage jobs. This is the current minimum wage level, you know, as of July 1st in different areas of Oregon. And we have an estimate of the number of minimum wage jobs in each region, at each level, and in each county. So you have that there as reference. This is actually based on 2016 data, because we have to make our current count based on data, because we don't have the most recent data yet. But it gives you an idea of how many jobs are impacted by the minimum wage increases by area. So overall, probably about 300,000 jobs in Oregon were directly impacted by the last increase. Although it could be more than that because the economy has grown since then. So that's probably our best way of measuring how many jobs are impacted. But looking at this over time, the number of minimum wage jobs and the percent of jobs that pay minimum wage has been remarkably steady because Oregon has, for a number of years, had minimum wage that's automatically adjusted due to inflation. So in this graph, it shows the first quarter of each year, because that's when the minimum wage used to increase on January 1st. The first quarter number of jobs that pay minimum wage, and that's the bar, and the line represents the share of total employment that was at minimum wage. And so the number has kind of averaged around 90,000 each year, just over time, and the share of jobs has been about 5%. And the most recent data point I have in here is actually third quarter, because now that the minimum wage increases on July 1st, I changed the count to third quarter, and that figure shows that we're kind of in line historically with that 2016 increase. So too early to tell about the 2017 increase, which is much larger. So we'll know about that when the data becomes available. I get asked about marijuana jobs a lot. I promise Jan didn't ask me specifically about this, but it's such a common question, I thought I'd add this in there. There are two approaches measuring cannabis employment, and there isn't a standard federal way to do it. Like, we have so much of our data is based on federal guidelines, but they don't have a federal marijuana industry. But we've come up with a really great way. Our staff has figured out a great way to track cannabis employment the best we can. And by a comparable level of how we count other jobs, there's 4,155 jobs at least that are in businesses that are selling marijuana or marijuana products growing, with an average wage of under $27,000 a year. That's as of second quarter 2017, so that's kind of our traditional count of jobs. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission issues worker permits, so everyone who works in the industry needs to have one of these, and there are a lot of worker permits out there, 18,000 active permits. I don't think all of those people are working. Like, they're not right now today at their job doing this. It's just you need to have the permit in order to legally work with marijuana. So the true number of people in the industry is probably somewhere but between our jobs count. It's probably a little higher when you include sole proprietors or people working as independent contractors that aren't captured in our data. But it's probably really not as high as the number of licenses that's just people legally allowed to work in the industry. So employers have a lot of jobs. We do a quarterly survey of employers and asking them if they have vacancies. If they do have vacancies, you know, tell us about it. What kind of occupation? How much does it pay? Is it difficult to fill? That sort of information, and create an estimate for the number of vacancies each quarter. And summer of this year, we reached a record number of vacancies, so 66,000 unfilled vacancies as of the summer. And the occupations with the largest number of vacancies were farm workers, which makes sense because of summertime, but also we hear from our operators that they're having a hard time finding enough workers, that they're seeing a worker shortage. Personal care aides, of course, to serve our aging population. Construction workers, as I mentioned, construction is the fastest growing industry in Oregon right now, and it was summertime, so a big need for construction laborers. Retail salespersons is the largest occupation, so that always has a lot of vacancies. Similar with retail or restaurant cooks, which is a another large occupation, and truck drivers. We're always hearing any sort of way we look at where employers are struggling to find enough workers, truck drivers is an occupation that almost always shows up near the top of the list. And this information is available by broad region. Central Oregon is reporting a relatively high number of vacancies. Of course, most of the vacancies are in the Portland metro area. But we also, this summer, we saw a lot of unfilled vacancies in the Mid-Valley area and a seasonal increase in vacancies for firefighters. And when we ask employers about their vacancies, we also ask if it's difficult to fill. And two-thirds of the vacancies were difficult to fill, according to employers. And so that, since there are a record number of vacancies, two-thirds of them were difficult to fill. There's a record number of difficult-to-fill vacancies. And the most recent data isn't available, so I'm falling back on 2016 average data for this. But difficult-to-fill vacancies, broadly speaking, are more likely to pay more. So employers are offering more for these positions that they're having difficulty to fill, and they're more likely to require previous experience. So we know time after time from reports from employers, they're looking for people who have previous job experience. So higher paying jobs that require a lot of experience seems to make the positions difficult to fill.
Can we ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
So on the difficult to, oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. So on the difficult to fill is that you mentioned the biggest issue was experience, but do you categorize all the different reasons like can't pass a drug test or whatever?
Yes.
I mean, maybe not on here, but do you track that?
Having next Chair Holvey and Vice Chair Barreto, yes. When they tell us, when employers tell us why they have a difficult to fill, we bucket that into different categories, and that's what's shown in this pie chart here.
I asked too soon. Thank you.
Over half of the reasons given were a combination of lack of applicants or lack of qualified applicants. So they're just not seeing the people that, you know, the people aren't applying for the job or is the ones that aren't meeting the minimum requirements. Some of the other categories are unfavorable working conditions. So this could be like a dirty job. You know, it's not a fun job, or it's a night shift work. It's just hard to fill people who want to work under those conditions. 9% of these vacancies are difficult to fill due to low wages. So and the employers are saying, I can't pay enough to attract the people that I need. Lack of work experience, 7%. And lack of soft skills is a pretty broad industry. Like, what does that mean? But that's where we put people saying, we can't fill this position because our applicants can't pass a drug test. So it could be stuff like not a good fit, but a variety of soft skills reasons, and that's where the not being able to pass a drug test fits. And 14% for other reasons.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you. So that 6%, what percent of those are likely to be drug-related then?
Chair Holvey, Representative Kinnemer. I don't know off the top of my head, but I think we can probably look into that and get back to you. So we'll see if we have that much detail there. So where are all the workers? Oregon's unemployment rate is historically low. 2017, we reached a record low level of unemployment. Comparable data goes back to 1976, so we're looking at the lowest unemployment in 40 years. I'd like to use the opportunity to define unemployment. It's the share of the population that is actively is in the labor force. So they're don't have a job, but they're actively looking for a job. So that's key here. A lot of people assume or they hear that you need to be receiving unemployment insurance benefits to be counted as unemployed. It's simply not true for these statistics. Anyone who is without a job but wants a job and is actively looking for one would be considered unemployed for these data. And this is based on a survey of households. So earlier I was talking about surveys of employers. This is more based on a survey of households. So we're asking people if they have a job, and if not, are they looking for one? So though overall unemployment is at a record low, it's obviously not so low for everybody. Black or African Americans in Oregon have a higher unemployment rate. American Indians and Alaska Native have a higher unemployment rate. People who identify with two or more races have a higher unemployment rate. People with a disability have a higher unemployment rate. Veterans have a higher unemployment rate than non-veterans. And teenagers also have a higher unemployment rate. So there are certainly groups of people that employers can still draw on to find additional workers. Looking at the unemployment rates by state with the map, this should also have a handout that has the most current unemployment rate by county. Looking at the map, the darker counties have higher unemployment rates, but many of these unemployment rates by county, even if they're high, are pretty low historically. We have comparable data going back to 1990, and I use Grant County as an example. Grant County has the highest unemployment rate in the state at 6.4%, But this year, Grant County actually reached the lowest unemployment rate it's had in 26 years. So relatively speaking, that high unemployment rate is actually very low for the history of the area. And here's another look at that. This shows each county's unemployment rate. The top of the red bar is the current unemployment rate. The top of the blue bar is the recessionary peak unemployment. And the yellow point is a record low. So many of those counties you see are real close to their record low. Some of them were added or set new lows earlier in the year. That just shows how far we've come in terms of unemployment in pretty much all areas of the state. And besides unemployment rate, other measures of labor underutilization confirm that we're in a tight labor market. So these indicators all reached new lows in 2017. Involuntary part-time workers, and those are people who are employed. They're not unemployed. They have a job, but they're working part-time, and they'd really rather be working a full-time job. They just going to get one, or their hours have been cut short. So about 70,000 people in Oregon, that's actually the lowest in the last 15 years. Long-term unemployed, so people who have been without a job but are still looking for a job, but have been without a job for 6 months or more, there's 22,000 of them in Oregon, but that's actually, again, the lowest it's been in about 15 years. And discouraged workers, are not in the labor force. They're not actively looking for a job. They had recently within the last year, but they stopped looking for work, aren't looking for work now because they don't think there's a job out there for them. And that's the reason they're not looking for one. 4,500 discouraged workers right now, but again, that's the lowest figure in 15 years. Very close to reaching a record low are people who aren't in the labor force but want a job. For whatever reason, they're not looking either because they're discouraged, they don't have transportation right now, childcare issues, maybe they're finishing up school and haven't started looking. For whatever reason, they're not looking for a job, so they're not in the labor force, and they're not counted as unemployed. At 5.7%, that's very close to reaching a record low for that figure. And the point of that is, I don't think there's a lot of people on the sidelines sort of ready to get into the labor force like there have been for years. You know, we're almost at next month will be the 10th anniversary of the start of the Great Recession. So for this long period of time, there have been a lot of people unemployed or underemployed in Oregon. Relatively, though, this is the tightest labor market we've seen in a decade. So where do we traditionally get workers when other supplies are relatively low? Of course, they move to Oregon, and they move to Oregon to find jobs. They like the style of living here. And this graph shows Portland State University estimates of population change every year. So Oregon has always added jobs since the mid-1980s. The light-colored green shows a natural increase in population, but the dark green shows the net in-migration, so how many more people are moving to Oregon than moving out. And although it dipped during the recession, we're seeing a lot of net in-migration, and I think that will be key to continued job growth in the state. One of the questions labor economists are looking at right now is, do we have enough people to take the jobs that are available in order to keep up our current rate of job growth? So that's it for my prepared remarks. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Nick. Questions, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on that last chart, the number of people coming in that migrate in, do you follow them and see how many of them actually get jobs when they come here, whether they have a job and that's why they come here, or how many come in and are unemployed or on welfare?
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Barreto, there isn't a data source to tell us these are the people moved in, these are the share that found jobs, or these are the folks who moved in to retire, or who moved in with other people who are finding jobs. So we just don't have that granularity of detail. So we do actually track the number of people who took jobs in Oregon who moved from other states. This is a different series that's not directly tied to this, but we sort of do have other angles to look at people moving to Oregon.
Thank you.
Thank you. Nick, any other questions? Nick, I've always wondered where legislators fall into those categories. Are we discouraged workers?
Underpaid.
You can follow up with me. So, Nick, I do appreciate the information, and you know, as much as the committee, I appreciate the committee also staying awake through most of it, and you know, it is valuable information and definitely more food for thought on where we're at, where we've been, and where we might go. So some really interesting. I'll be interested to see how this plays out over the next couple of years as well. So I bet you we'll have you back at some point. And I apologize for butchering your last name again. Belichick, I believe.
Yeah, Chair Holvey, Belichick. And it helps if you can read Latvian. Then you can just look at it and read it. But if you don't, it is a struggle. Yeah. For real.
Yeah. I'll keep trying. And
most of us are proficient in that, aren't we?
Yeah.
So thank you very much. And I'm sure if we have any follow-up questions on specific data points, committee members can get that to our committee administrator, and we'll forward them on to you as I'm thinking of a couple right now. So thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, corrupt in the sheep.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well,
I do
yes,
like
you don't really need to ask, but you have my complete permission to be excused.
Okay.
Lucky you. See you.
So the next element of our agenda today is an informational meeting on prevailing wage and prevailing wage rates. You know, it's a topic that I'm familiar with, and sometimes I assume everybody is, and then I find out everybody really isn't. So I thought it would be informative to hear from the Bureau of Labor and Industry, the Oregon Employment Department, and then a couple from some of our trade unions who deal with this on a daily basis. So with that, I'm going to call up... maybe we'll start.
He's here.
We'll start out with Boley, perhaps.
Tim is here.
Oh, is he?
Just saw him in the hallway. He was coming
in. Yeah. Well, that's okay. We'll start with Boley anyway.
And the Employment Department.
Jason Payton and Gerhardt. Is Gerhardt here?
Yeah.
Oh, there he is. Out in the hall. Knockdown.
Who's up first?
Actually, we have Gerhardt up first, so since he's ready to go, and he probably thought he was later in the agenda. We're just a tad bit ahead of schedule, so take your time.
Okay. Really? Okay.
Welcome, and I appreciate you being here, you know, to kind of give us a review of prevailing wages and how that fits into Oregon law, your agencies, and in particular, some points about how prevailing wage rates are established. So, Gerhardt.
Sure. For the record, my name is Gerhardt Teubel. I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Working in tandem today with Jason Payton, and we're going to talk about briefly about the history of Oregon's prevailing wage rate law, with an emphasis on the scope of the law and the survey process in particular, how the prevailing wage rates are established in the first place. And in doing so, I thought I would begin with just a summary of the history of the prevailing wage law, which has been around since 1959, make a brief comparison with the United States, the USDOL's prevailing wage regulations under the federal prevailing wage law, and then turn it over to Jason to talk more particularly about the survey process and what that includes. So to begin, as I mentioned, the Oregon prevailing wage rate law dates back to 1959, and it is modeled on the federal law, the Davis-Bacon Act, which actually came into existence in the early 1930s. So Oregon was, of the states that have prevailing wage laws, Oregon was somewhat late to that. It was about 25 years after the federal government enacted its own prevailing wage rate regulations. And like the federal regulations, the state prevailing wage rate law, when it was enacted, required contractors on public works projects to pay their workers at wage rates which reflected the wage standard for the area where the work was being performed. So, in other words, the idea was that government construction contracts should not play a role in eroding local wage standards. So, you know, if a plumber in Salem was paid at a certain rate, the prevailing wage rate, that on a government project, a contractor should not be allowed to pay that person less than what that going rate was. The rates themselves, at least when the state law first came into being, was established actually by the public agency that was awarding the contract. So the agency, and I'm not sure exactly how this worked, but would get together with the contractors on the project and labor organizations in the area, and they would decide collectively what those wage rates would be for that project. And Boley's only role really at that time was to intervene if there was some kind of dispute over what those wage rates should be. That process apparently wasn't all that satisfactory, because already in 1967, so only a few years after the law was passed, the law was amended to require the state's labor commissioner to annually determine what the prevailing wage rate regulations would be and to publish those rates so that contracting agencies and contractors would know what was required to be paid on projects. At the same time, the law permitted the commissioner to consider other types of information in establishing the prevailing wage rate, like the rates, the prevailing wage rates established by the U.S. Department of Labor, or collectively bargained wage rates for particular trades in an area. 2 years later, the law was amended again to include payment of fringe benefits. Prior to that time, contractors were only required to pay the base wage that was the standard for the area. But there was a recognition that many contractors provided fringe benefits to workers, pension plan or health insurance or something like that. So in 1969, the law was amended that on a prevailing wage project, contractors would also have to pay the equivalent of that, the fringe benefits that were offered to workers in that area, either by providing the fringe benefits themselves or paying workers the cash equivalent of what those benefits were. Now, jumping ahead to 1995, the threshold for coverage on a prevailing wage or a public works increased from $10,000 to $25,000. This means that at this time, if the project cost less than $25,000, it wasn't covered. A prevailing wage fee was added to the law, which was payable by contractors. On projects. They would pay this fee, and the proceeds from the fees would be used to pay the costs of conducting a prevailing wage rate survey, along with Boley providing educational programs to contractors and contracting agencies and the public on requirements of the prevailing wage law, as well as supporting the investigation and enforcement of the law. Then in 1997, the law was amended again to require BOLI to rely on an annual independent survey for determining the prevailing wage rates. And again, it allowed the commissioner to consider additional information if it appeared that the survey data was not sufficient to establish what those rates were. A few years later, the threshold for coverage was again increased, this time from $25,000 to $50,000. And then in 2007, there was a substantial change or addition to or expansion of the definition of what a public works was. Up until this point, it was basically a project that was contracted or carried on by a public agency. But in recognition that a lot of projects were going forward as private-public partnerships, whereas where a public agency might not be directly involved but was providing significant funding to the project, the legislature changed the definition to include projects, private projects, that had $750,000 or more of funds of a public agency, or where the project would result in a public agency occupying at least 25% of the square footage of that completed project. As I mentioned, Oregon's law is modeled on the federal law, so it's not surprising that it is that the two laws are similar in many respects. Basically, both laws require contractors to pay workers at the set wage standards for the areas where the work is being performed. There's not much difference between state and federal law in that regard. However, state law, in terms of what projects are covered, state law has more categories. I mentioned the three major ones, the projects that are carried on and contracted for by a public agency, projects that use $750,000 or more of public funds, and those projects which will be occupied by a public agency at the rate of 25% or more. On the federal side, however, a prevailing wage project is either a project where the federal government is directly contracting for construction work. So, for example, the U.S. Post Office decides it wants to build another post office in a city. They would require that the workers on that project be paid the federal prevailing wage. Or it could be that the federal government is simply providing financial assistance to a project. And this usually happens through whatever kind of federal legislation provides the funding. So, for example, there's a federal transportation act which allows the federal government to give money to states for road maintenance and highway construction. And those that enacting legislation would require that the federal Davis-Bacon rates be paid to workers. On the federal side, projects that cost less than $2,000 are not covered. On the state side, it's now $50,000. Federal government, the USUL for the federal government, establishes the prevailing wage rates for federal projects, and they do this through a voluntary survey of contractors, contractors associations, labor organizations, and other interested parties who might provide data to them. They don't do this on an annual basis, but they set up a schedule of in various states and counties of how frequently those surveys will be conducted. For Oregon, we conduct an annual survey. So every year, BOLI, through the Oregon Employment Department, sends out a survey to contractors asking them for information, and that becomes the basis of the prevailing wage rates that BOLI publishes for state public works projects. Both Oregon and the federal government define prevailing wages in basically the same way, which, as I've already addressed, and both allow for a use of an average if it cannot be determined what the prevailing wage rate is. That is, both under both the federal and state programs, essentially a survey is conducted, and if the survey shows that 50% or more of the workers in an area are paid at the same rate, which would be like the union rate, for example, then those union rates would prevail for that area or region. If the union rates do not prevail, then an average rate is used for each classification in that region, or for each classification that didn't prevail in that region. Oregon is one of 30 states to have prevailing average rate laws. You know, in each state is unique in the way that it implements this law, though the purpose is generally, you know, the same. How prevailing wage is interpreted can be different. In some states, for example, collective bargaining agreements are simply adopted as the prevailing wage rates. Other states, like Oregon, conduct a survey and then consider other kinds of information to establish the prevailing wage rates. But even in those states that, you know, conduct a survey, the formula is not always the same. Some states go with an average, some states go with the mean rate or the median rate or the modal rate. So it's across the board as far as how states approach this issue of what is the prevailing wage for any particular trade or classification of work. As I mentioned, BOLI contracts with the Employment Department. We've done so since 1996 to conduct the survey for Oregon. Over the years, the survey methodology has changed. Prior to 2010, that methodology was basically what we would call a peak week methodology, where contractors would be asked to look at their, you know, their work data for a year and decide which week in that year was the peak week, when were the most hours of work, when was the most work activity, and then they would report information based on that peak week. You know, what kind of workers did they have, the classification of work, what were they paid as an hourly rate, what fringe benefits were they given, were they using journey workers or less than journey workers, where was the work, you know, performed. But in response to concerns with how efficient or whether that was sufficient just to look at a peak week, in 2009, Commissioner Avakian asked the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee and the Employment Department to make some recommendations about how the survey might be changed to provide more, to ensure that the data that we were receiving was valid, and also to decrease the burden on contractors to provide that kind of information. And based on those recommendations, the survey methodology was revised, so that rather than a peak week, we were looking at four separate work weeks throughout the year, one in each quarter, and contractors were asked to provide the same kind of documentation for those 4 weeks. You know, the 4 weeks were known so that contractors could prepare for the information that they needed to provide to comply with the survey. At the same time, an attempt was made to eliminate unnecessary data reporting, and so the decision was made that if, you know, a collective bargained rate for a trade in a region was determined to have prevailed for at least 3 years, then that trade would not be surveyed for 3 years, the thinking being that, you know, the results wouldn't really change and we could alleviate, at least for some contractors, that they wouldn't have to be providing wage information in response to a survey. However, a couple of years ago, in consultation with the Employment Department, it was decided that method was having some unintentional consequences of limiting the amount of data that we were receiving, and that was creating difficulties in determining a statewide rate when, say, a collective bargained rate didn't prevail. And so most recently, the methodology was again changed so that we have a rotating cycle of trades. So for a three-year period, every trade will be surveyed at least two times in 1 year. Those contractors won't have to participate in the survey. So I think that's sort of how, in at a high level, how the survey is conducted, and, you know, how we came to the point where we are. I turn it over now to Jason to talk more specifically about the survey process, unless there's any questions I can answer at this point.
Yeah, I think we'll just hold our questions to the end. give people a little more time to think of one.
All right. Well, with that, good afternoon, Chair Hulvey, members of the committee. My name is Jason Payton. I am the occupational economist for the Oregon Employment Department's Workforce and Economic Research Division. Prior to that role, for about 5.5 years, I was the program coordinator for a wage and benefits survey that we conduct on behalf of the Bureau of Labor and Industries each year to collect that relevant information that they use for their determination process. What I'm going to share with you today is a little bit more in-depth description of exactly what we do in terms of our survey methods, and to put that into context in terms of how we collect information and why we collect the information the way we do, I'm going to compare our survey methods with those of our federal counterparts at the U.S. Department of Labor, who conduct what's known as the Davis-Bacon Survey. This is a nationwide survey that collects very similar information to collect relevant information that the Department of Labor's policymakers use to make federal determine prevailing wage rates for federal works projects. So as Gerhardt described back in 1996, we were contracted by the Bureau of Labor and Industries to conduct our first wage and benefits survey. And since that time, we have effectively conducted an annual survey to collect this information. One of the questions that we get from stakeholders on a regular basis is, why is it that the Oregon Employment Department, an agency that doesn't really have anything from an administrative standpoint, doing collecting information for BOLI? And the short answer is, it comes down to expertise and independence. The Workforce and Economic Research Division has a mission of providing quality labor market information to Oregonians. That includes educators, job seekers, businesses, and policymakers alike, so that they can make informed choices. We do that in part by employing staff who are dedicated and specializing in conducting independent, typically wage surveys, to collect labor market information and labor market research and analyze the results and provide that to the public. In addition to that expertise of specializing in wage and labor market research, we also have a degree of independence. As Gerhardt alluded to in the statute, the commissioner is required to determine prevailing rates of wage at least once a year by means of an independent wage survey. And because our agency is essentially not involved with the administration and enforcement of the law, we are able to provide that independent source of information that the statute basically describes. The survey that we conduct each year is known as the Construction Industry Occupation Wage Survey. It's an annual survey that goes out to businesses around the state and region and collects wage and benefit information from the employees that they have that are working on what's considered construction projects of a similar nature to those that the Bureau of Labor and Industries would actually have to make determinations for. So as a result, essentially, we're a non-residential construction survey, and that's our primary focus in terms of the information we're collecting from businesses. In a similar fashion, the Federal Davis-Bacon Survey is a nationwide program that collects information at the statewide level. It's a periodic survey that collects relevant information from contractors that they've identified so that they can tabulate estimates and use that information to make determinations. In terms of our survey, it's an annual survey, and so it starts in May of each year. We actually conduct a market review by actually sending out a market review survey to businesses around the state and simply ask the question, are you performing work on non-residential construction projects? And if you are, we're going to be sending a survey form to you. In addition to that survey, we also evaluate tens of thousands of issued building permits from various municipalities around the state, as well as Department of Transportation award notifications, Department of Transportation first-tier subcontractor lists, and we also look at past survey responses. We're for the most part, dealing with the same businesses every year, and so we have a pretty good idea of who might be providing this information to us on a regular basis. Based off of that market review, in July of each year, we send survey booklets out to these businesses, and from July until the end of October, we'll actually collect that information. Our research analyst staff will field thousands of phone calls and emails from businesses around the state to clarify any questions they may have with regards to what we're actually asking them to report, as well as any kind of questions they may have in terms of how to report in an accurate and complete fashion, such that we can actually tabulate those estimates. During that same time, our research analyst staff will also review the information and edit it into such a format that we can actually tabulate estimates. That means that we review archived historical information from the same business, essentially asking the question, are these firms reporting similar wages, skills, union affiliation as they did the year before or even 3 years or even more historically? We follow up with contractors that may have reported in an incomplete fashion. Perhaps they've not reported where the work is taking place, or perhaps they may have included things like overtime in their wage information, things we need to identify before we actually use that information. And finally, one of the advantages we have as being part of the Oregon Employment Department is that while we collect information from thousands of businesses, these same businesses report payroll records to our Unemployment Insurance Division, which means that we actually have an independent source of payroll employment, wages, and reported hours that we can actually lean back on and evaluate the information that we're seeing from our survey form. So because we're a part of the Oregon Employment Department, we have a second source of information to verify what we're actually seeing on our survey forms. Once we've completed our review process, at the start of November, we'll actually release what we call preliminary estimates to the commissioner and the prevailing wage unit of the Bureau of Labor Industries. About a week after that, we'll actually screen that information so that we identify information that may be considered confidential. And anything that's considered non-confidential around the middle of November, we'll actually release through a mailing list that the Bureau of Labor Industries maintains. And so basically, the public and the stakeholders in this process have access to our wage estimates and tabulated information almost as soon as the Bureau of Labor Industries has that information as well. So in total, that's effectively what we do as a survey unit and the process in which we work through to get information to the Bureau of Labor and Industries each year. As Gerhardt will describe in sort of the determination process, we are involved in making sure that the Bureau of Labor and Industries has an informed idea of whether or not we're actually collecting a complete set of information, and where supplemental information is provided by third parties, there's an opportunity for the Bureau of Labor and Industries to actually contact us directly and really thoroughly vet whether or not a particular contractor is being reported in terms of hours, or if we actually have a complete set of information from them. And so that's effectively what we do each year. To put that into context, to describe how we relate to the U.S. Department of Labor survey, I think it's important to note that going as far back as 20 years ago, much of what we do as a survey and a program is founded upon what the U.S. Department of Labor has been doing for several decades. And what that means is that we essentially are trying to provide answers to the same relevant questions that both policymakers are asking, in the sense that we're trying to collect information from contractors that say, for any particular trade, where is the work occurring in the state? What average wage is a skilled, experienced worker that you're employing typically getting paid to do that work? If you're paying fringe benefits, what is the typical fringe benefit package? Are you paying health insurance or contributing to a 401k contribution? And important to the actual determination process at the federal and state level, for any particular trade, what is the overall representation of that trade by union representation? What is the percentage of those employees that are union members? And so those are the key aspects of both survey programs that we're trying to essentially tabulate estimates for. In order to do that, our survey methods in many ways are continue to be very similar. We both conduct what's considered a census survey. Census being that once we've done that marker review and identified all the contractors that could potentially be doing non-residential construction work, that is a list of all the folks that we'll actually be sending out surveys to. It means that we're not a sampling survey. Much of what we do as a division are considered random or stratified random surveys, which means we're just getting a quick smattering of businesses to represent everybody. In this case, we're sending out survey forms to everybody and trying to get that information. In addition to that, much of, as Gerhard alluded in terms of the comparison of the laws, our surveys use very similar definitions and terms. And so when we talk about things like bona fide fringe benefits or occupational definitions, you're going to see very similar definitions. For instance, our survey uses occupational descriptions or typical duties that are defined by the Bureau of Labor and Industries. In kind, the Bureau of Labor and Industries will try to mirror, if not be identical to, the definitions used by the U.S. Department of Labor. And so when we talk about comparing our survey results at the state level compared to U.S. Department of Labor results, we're basically talking about the same occupation. So if you're talking about landscapers or carpenter group one or power equipment operator group six, those are some of the occupations we collect information for, and the definitions are essentially the same. The other main similarity that we still share today with the federal Davis-Bacon survey is that many of the questions we specifically ask one business or another is basically the same. We're asking where the work is taking place. Where is that job site? We're asking what number of employees that employer is employing on the job site. What occupation, what trade were they working in to perform that work? Are these journey-level, experienced, licensed trades folks, or are we talking about sub-journey, entry-level, or apprentice workers performing that work? And notably, are they actually being represented? Are they part of a collective bargaining agreement? Are they members of unions? We also collect information about the basic hourly wage rate and, again, like the feds do, a bona fide fringe benefit package, which is basically what's considered a benefit paid to directly or on behalf of the employee on a regular basis. So that's where you're talking about health insurance, pension contributions, 401k contributions, paid vacation leave, or any kind of funds that might be provided to the employee as part of an effort to participate in continuing education classes or fulfill those requirements. Where we differ in terms of our system, and effectively at the crux when we talk to stakeholders about the question of why is it that you might see determination differences at the federal level compared to state, it really comes down to a number of key differences in our survey methodology. For the Oregon Construction Survey that we conduct each year, we are designed, going back 20 years, to be a statistical survey, which means that when we actually go back to talk about our budget, staffing, timeline of collecting information, we set out and ask the question of how many responses do we need to get in order to tabulate estimates for 14 statutorily established wage rate regions. That's effectively what's established in statute. In order to do that, we have to have a response rate that's very high. In fact, we have target thresholds of getting a response rate from businesses of about 85%. And I'm proud to say that my predecessors and I have had the ability to do that consistently over the years. By contrast, the federal Davis-Bacon survey, due to limitations of how big the program is and how much information they have to be responsible for, is not considered a statistical survey. They only have a target threshold of trying to get about a response rate of around 25%. So in terms of the reliability of the actual information that's being provided, you're going to see some pretty big differences between our two programs. In addition to that, the federal Davis-Bacon survey will actually remain open, or what's called an extended time period, until they've reached the 25% response rate and they've received enough sufficient information to make a determination for what's known as key occupations. These are 12 pre-identified occupations such as carpenters, power equipment operators, and plumbers. Once they do that, they'll close a survey and then start the process to make those determinations. Another big difference when we talk about what we're seeing in terms of our survey results and the information being provided by the federal government is the fact that our survey is an annual survey, which means that we're conducting this survey every year, soliciting this information from contractors throughout the state, and getting that information to Bowie every fall in early November. By contrast, the federal Davis-Bacon survey is periodic, which means that some states like the state of Oregon do not get surveyed very often. In fact, the determinations that we're working with today at the federal level are based off of determinations that were released in 2009. And since that time, there really hasn't been any effort to update that information from a survey standpoint. There's some steps that they go through from a determination standpoint that if a union rate prevails for a particular county, they'll actually get information as the years go by if that particular trade union will actually submit the updated contract to the Department of Labor. The determinations, just as a reference for Oregon, that came out in 2009 are actually based off of survey data that was conducted in 2005. So we're talking about information that's about 12 years old. And in addition to that, if you go to the Department of Labor's website right now, there's no planned survey to be conducted here in Oregon, at least in the near future. In terms of when we talk about differences, as Gerhardt described, we went through a reform process. We had an independent review led by the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee to come up with a set of recommendations to present to the commissioner, and one of those was the pre-selected work weeks. Effectively, the concern was we were not getting enough representative information at the time to really have a descriptive estimate for what's going on for an entire year, that perhaps especially some of our larger businesses in the state were not getting represented. And as a result, one of the recommendations that came up during that process was identifying four pre-selected work weeks that basically contractors would know that are coming up. The particular work weeks that we collect information for actually align to many of the similar payroll reporting periods that they would actually submit quarterly contribution reports to the Oregon Employment Department. So when we're talking about the ease of providing this information, the four pre-selected work weeks actually mirror in many ways the payroll time periods where they actually be providing payroll tax information for. So there's a bit of a continuity there. Finally, one of the things that I'd like to point out is the information that you see from the U.S. Department of Labor and in many ways what is compared to our survey results are two different things. Effectively, we're talking about the actual survey results as opposed to U.S. Department of Labor determinations, whereas there's an entire process where the Bureau of Labor and Industries will actually be making that official determination. So when we look at what's available to the public, for the most part, we're actually seeing the end effect of what the Department of Labor has seen in terms of local wage and benefit information. And in addition to that, they've actually, if they don't have enough information, rolled these various counties up into sub-state regions or actually into a statewide estimate and use that information to make a determination. When we look at the Department of Labor releases with the determinations, that information is not necessarily available. And that's a big difference between the Fed program as compared to the Oregon Prevailing Wage process and our survey. Whereas in November, we release our information to BOLI, but a week later, that information in almost real time is provided to the public. So as the Bureau of Labor and Industries is going through their determination process, you really have the opportunity to see that information as a policymaker and a stakeholder in the process as they're making those determinations. So to give you an idea of all the work that's occurring from July until October and give you an idea of what information we're actually providing to the Bureau of Labor and Industries, this is actually a snapshot of some of the detailed information we provided to the Bureau of Labor and Industries last week. So what you see here is that we actually provide not just a snapshot of the data that we have from this year. We actually provide information over several years so that the Bureau of Labor and Industries has a comprehensive idea of what's been going on for that trade in any given region that we have information for. As I described, our goal as a program is to provide information for 14 wage rate regions. Currently, the last 2 years, we've been able to produce estimates for anywhere between 76% and 80% of the wage rate region trade combinations that we're responsible to actually try and produce estimates for. By contrast, if we're talking about the federal Davis-Bacon program, their surveys when audited in 2011 and 1997 showed that typically the vast majority of the wage determinations were actually based off of different geographies, either regional groups that were established through the determination process or actually a statewide estimate. So in terms of differences, we have a pretty high threshold in terms of how much information we can provide to the Bureau of Labor and Industries. So with that, if you don't have any questions yet, which I'm sure there will be, I'll turn things over to Gerhardt to actually describe how that information is used in their determination process.
Yeah, so I would just add to what Jason has said. The Employment Department provides us with information, non-confidential information, about what it has found through the survey process, and we make that available to the public, both on our website, but we also make it available to the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee, as well as a long list of individuals and organizations that are part of a listserv that we have that ask for information relating to the prevailing wage rates, and we offer them the opportunity to provide supplemental data if, upon review of the survey results, they think that the survey is missing something, essentially. If they think, for example, that looking at a certain region for a certain trade, you know, the number of hours reported are very low, but they know that a project was going on in that region during that year that's being surveyed, they can provide that kind of information to us, and then we can consider that as we're establishing the prevailing wage rates. What we ask them to do is you know, provide information on construction that is non-residential, not to include apprentice hours or wages or hours or data that Jason has already collected with the Employment Department, because we don't want to duplicate that information. They should provide us, you know, with the name of the contractor and the job so that we can verify where the work was being done, how many hours are being reported, and all the other kind of information that will help us to determine what that prevailing wage rate should be. We then consult with the Employment Department to make sure we back out any kind of information that does appear to be duplicative. And at that point, if it seems like it's usable information that shows us that within a trade and within a region, there has been a substantial amount of work that hasn't been reported through the survey process itself, we can include that, add that to the data that the Employment Department has provided us. And if that changes the results, that is, if we look at that region, that trade, and now it appears that more than 50% of the work was performed by union workers, then we would include that, and those rates would be the prevailing wage rates for that trade in that region. And then, you know, the rates are issued or published January 1st. We do some updates through the year as we get more information, if collective bargaining agreements change, for example, and they are again updated in a second publication comes out in July. And then those rates will apply to whatever public works projects are let during that period of time when the rates are in effect. So when the project is advertised, the rates that apply are those that were in effect at the time that the project is advertised.
Thanks.
That was, there's still some people awake here.
Impressive.
Yeah, it's pretty technical stuff, no doubt. I'm curious, though, some of the information, I'm judging from what you just said, is confidential. Some of it is not confidential. How do you make sure that the hours being reported are being reported in the correct region?
So, Chair, hopefully that's actually a very good question. You know, in terms of historical information, we do have multiple years of survey responses from that particular contractor. So, you know, if there's a particular inconsistency in terms of where they're reporting work, that's something that might be reviewed when we're actually looking at historical information. In addition to that, we'll actually look at the information and supplemental information that's shared to us by the Bureau of Labor and Industries. So if we have a trade union that's reported power equipment operators that says that they were working in Region 5 versus 4, that'll essentially clue us in to actually follow up with those particular respondents to verify that.
Okay. And the reason I ask is over the years I've seen and had people talk to me from several different trades about anomalies that happen where
you know, they recognized that they had a lot of work in a region, and the regions around them all prevailed, but the one that had all this work didn't. And, you know, oftentimes that then goes, you know, to a communication to Bole and all that. But very rarely do they go backwards. Well, maybe I shouldn't say that. They do go back and fix things sometimes. But, you know, that them creates that anomaly. And just, you know, that's why I was asking how confident of you the hours that are being reported, especially if when they're confidential, are accurate, especially in terms of, you know, I guess classification would always be a tough one, but you know, where the work's being performed. I do know that sometimes our construction industry is not near as county by county economies anymore.
Right.
They're much more regional, and contractors travel all over the state, if not all over the West, performing work.
Yeah.
And so, you know, having all these little tiny regions kind of makes me wonder sometimes, when was the last time they took a look at whether that's really an accurate depiction of the construction industry? You know, when our contractors in Lane County are oftentimes working in Portland and vice versa, and in Eastern Oregon, all over the state. And so it's a much more fluid and diverse economy than it probably was 50 years ago. And so I'm sure the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee looks at topics like that from time to time. But I'm just kind of curious how you ensure the accuracy of this, and whether it's gotten to the point of minutia that you have these anomalies from one side of town to the next, or, you know, basically, mm-hmm. like from Corvallis to Eugene, for example, and have huge differences in the prevailing wage there, which are very similar, you know, in terms of the amount of projects they have sometimes. And, yeah, I just, you know, kind of wonder, when you see those anomalies, do they, you just go, oh, that's the way the survey ends up, or, I mean, you kind of went through a process of how you, you know, look for anomalies, I assume, but without the data there, or without reliable data or assurance that the data is accurate and where it's reported, you know, I don't know what the solution to that is.
Chair Holby, that's a really great question. You know, in terms of all the data and information that we collect, that's actually one of the most difficult ones for us to verify as we're going through the process. One of the reasons being is that when we talk about things like building permits and where the work is taking place, there's not one single source to identify all the building permits in the state. You know, the Department of Consumer Business Services has the Oregon e-permitting system, which is one of the resources that we have to look at not only the projects that are going around in the state, but as well as the magnitude and value, essentially, of these projects. But by no means does it cover all the various localities that are issuing those building permits. And so we do have some limitations in terms of how much we can independently verify everything that's reporting to us geographically speaking. I think that's one of the limitations that's known as a survey process, and I think is important in the process that we talked about in terms of the determinations and how third parties provide that information, because it really is another pair of eyes that's looking on that survey response. And while much of the information that they report is covered by our survey, when we actually compare firm-to-firm basis, there's always circumstances when that supplemental information provides us insight and gives us a heads-up that something's off. But in terms of regional dynamics and characteristics, you know, effectively, we're still basically representing the information that we've collected from those contractors. And it's in terms of what's going on regionally, that's where the determination and that supplemental information provided to Bole really pays dividends.
Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a sort of question backing off of this discussion about the regions. And it looks like there's 14 regions, which seems like sort of a high number of regions for the state of Oregon. So I'm curious, you know, when was the last time, how do you determine how many regions is appropriate, and how do you decide what they are, and when was the last time they were reviewed?
That's a good question. I don't know the first.
Representative Fay, Chairman Hovey. I mean, I can't say with certainty it's been the 14 regions for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's going back to 1959 or whether that was changed at some point. I mean, I have heard discussion about perhaps, you know, 14 regions in today's economy is not the right number of regions, maybe. And I think there have been proposals perhaps in the past to narrow that down or to reconfigure the state of Oregon into a different number of regions along different lines. But 14 regions is statutorily what is in the law, and so that's how we survey the rates.
Well, thanks. I think we got enough time. I wanted to hear from some union representatives that live with prevailing wage rates and get some of their perspectives on prevailing wage law and prevailing wage rates. So I want to thank you for putting together this presentation for us. And thankful that we still have several committee members here. I was kind of had a wager of how many would still be left at this point. But I appreciate you being here.
No,
and
thank you.
Certainly if we have follow-up questions, we'll get them to you.
I'm intrigued that he knew I was a landscaper.
Should I be worried?
All surveys are confidential. I get a chance off and on to watch this committee, so I enjoy what you guys do.
He's heard me screaming.
Well, thank you very much for being here.
What did you say about a landscaper?
Up next, Tim Frew and Corey Elliott.
He pointed at you when he said titan of industry. And then somewhere in between us when he said crazy.
Tim, as we're approaching the 5 o'clock hour, I thought I'd let you go first and see how we do.
Great.
I appreciate you being here and giving us your perspective on prevailing wage law and prevailing wage rates.
Okay. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my statements will be brief and certainly less technical. My name is Tim Frew. I serve as Executive Secretary for the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council. We represent more than 30,000 workers in 22 member unions. I apologize if some of this might be redundant to what was said earlier, but these were my prepared remarks. I'm here today to discuss prevailing wage laws at the state and federal level. The basic purpose of prevailing wage is to prevent out-of-state companies from underbidding projects to the detriment of local companies and workers. It does this by requiring contractors and subcontractors to pay workers the local area wage rate and fringe benefits for corresponding work on similar projects in the area. The federal government, 25 states, in many cities and counties have prevailing wage laws governing public contracts. Since about a quarter of annual construction output in the U.S. is spent on government-owned construction projects, prevailing wage law is important in protecting local companies and workers and is popular across the political spectrum. Federal prevailing wage law is known as the Davis-Bacon Act of 1931, and the idea came from Representative Robert Bacon of New York. He noticed that workers from Alabama were being paid for the construction of a Veterans Bureau hospital in his Long Island district. Representative Bacon became concerned about poor working conditions, displacement of local workers, and competitive pressure toward lower wages. His solution was very simple. He introduced a bill that requires contractors and subcontractors to pay prevailing wages and fringe benefits to workers. This would level the playing field for local companies to compete with out-of-state and sometimes foreign-owned companies. The bill was signed into law by President Herbert Hoover. The federal law works by conducing contractor surveys of worker wages and fringe benefits in communities throughout the country. Based on those surveys, a determination is made about the market rate for wages and fringe benefits in each region. Oregon's law works the same way. It was passed in 1959 and signed into law by Governor Mark Hatfield. Prevailing wage has been effective at maintaining local labor standards and ensuring local companies have a fair shot at large public contracts. prevailing wage is good for the workforce, good for developers, and good for the general public. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Chair Holby, and fellow members of the committee. My name's Corey Elliott. I'm with the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters. We cover six states: Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, and Alaska. You know, I came here with similar remarks as the two gentlemen before us gave you a great thorough, you know, history of Davis-Bacon and prevailing wage, so I won't get into that. You had mentioned some anomalies in the Oregon system where, you know, we're pretty certain that, you know, our rates may, you know, should have prevailed in a certain area, and they didn't. And I think that part of that might have to do with the snapshot mentality, or the 4 weeks out of the year of not getting a full representation of the hours that have been worked in a specific area, because there's areas where we didn't have the majority, but our rates prevailed in that district. So I think that there is maybe some fine tuning we can do to help that calculation out. I know in other states, as was mentioned earlier, and looking at the statistics and the percentages of what the rates, what the amount of hours at our union, you can basically just use the union collectively bargained rate as the prevailed rate, because if we have the majority of the workers in that area, and we're paying our members exactly the same amount of dollars in the fringe benefits, you know, it makes sense that that's going to be the prevailed rate, and that's, I mean, I guess that won't apply to every single county or district or these 14 zones that you guys are working with, but I think maybe with some fresh ideas and some new calculations that maybe we could come up with some alternatives to that.
So looks like they're wrapped up. Questions? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you said 25 states have prevailing wage, and I think one of the other fellows said 30 states. So, and then we're talking about consistency between the states. But the states that don't have a prevailing wage law, how do they operate? You know, when you're talking about other companies coming into the states and undercutting, then are they just free to have whoever comes in work for whatever rates?
Chair Holby, Representative Barreto, I know that as far as addressing the 30 states and the 25 states, I think the 25 states is accurate because there have been states that have just recently repealed the prevailing wage laws. And two of those states, if I might, for example, Wisconsin repealed its prevailing wage law, and there was a 53% increase in contracts to out-of-state companies. And there was a Republican Indiana House Assistant Majority Leader, Ed Soliday, admitted that legislation passed to Indiana to repeal the state's prevailing wage law hasn't saved a penny. And that's documented.
If I might add, Chair Holby, to go along with that, the benefits to the community for, you know, keeping those local contractors employed, aside from bringing outside state contractors in, those contractors come into the state, they make the money, then they leave, they go home. And that money gets spent in their district, where if you have prevailing wage rates that are mandatory in certain areas, then those contractors that are local get those contracts, and their employees that are hired in that area get those contracts, and they spend the money in the community. It doesn't leave your state. So that's another benefit to, you know, collectively prevailing wage.
Chair Holby, Representative Barreto, if I might add to that, is that specifically blue-collar construction workers in the 25 states with average and strong prevailing wage laws contribute $3,289 per year in federal income taxes on average after credits and deductions are adjusted for differences in cost of living. Their equivalents in the 25 states with weak or no prevailing wage laws only contribute $1,964 in annual federal income taxes.
Thank you.
That's an impressive statistic. Representative Fahey, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm curious how much of an issue you think noncompliance is with prevailing wage rate laws. So contractors or subcontractors who are supposed to pay prevailing wage rates on projects but don't, how much of an issue is that? And when it happens, do you feel like the current recourse for enforcement is sufficient or effective?
Representative Fahey and Chair Holby. The underground economy is a major issue, both in Washington and Oregon, most of the states that I operate in. In certain instances, we have a single documented worker that maybe has three undocumented workers that work as a team. So that one, on paper, it looks like that one documented worker is getting paid the proper salary, but then he then goes and shares it with the team that is not on the payroll. They're there and they're a liability. If they get hurt, they're just sent home because they're technically not an employee. They're being paid as a contractor. There's a slew of issues regarding the payroll fraud and underground economy, and I know that the Attorney General in Washington State is looking to enforce that and fight that on a personal level. He's worked with the Carpenters a lot to come up with legislation to combat that, but I don't know if BOLA is the same with LNI in Washington, but the lack of funds to enforce and to follow and track and go after these contractors, because it's like whack-a-mole. They'll pop up in a different name. If they get busted for not being in compliance, they'll start another company with a different name, sell all their assets to the new company, and then they'll do it all over again. And so by the time we catch up to them, it's hard because there's no resources to track them. So I would assume that it's a similar issue in Oregon.
Representative Holvey, Chair Holvey, Representative Fahey. I think BOLI does a pretty good job as far as identifying poor contractors. They have a list that they put out, I think, quarterly, and that's disseminated amongst the contractors. With that, if they're a bad player, then they're not eligible to bid on prevailing wage projects.
That's pretty stiff.
So can you comment, there was another aspect of this, and, bad on me for not inviting a couple of contractors, and I'll rectify that in the future. But when a rate doesn't prevail in a particular region, so the rate then is less than the union rate. And so what impact does that have on the union contractors in being able to work on public projects? I would assume that they might have trouble,
Absolutely, Chair Holvey. It's the same way as competing with an outside contractor that doesn't have to abide by the same prevailing rates. We have a negotiated contract in Oregon where all carpenters make somewhere around $36.63 and plus their fringe package. So if we're competing against a prevailing wage rate that's, say, $32, $4 every hour per journeyman per, job site, that adds up pretty quick. So that does make it more difficult for our union contractors to compete in those same markets.
Yeah, and I would imagine, and I'll probably follow up with the statisticians on that, that actually has an impact on the future prevailing wage rates, because the union contractors really aren't on a level playing field for achieving those jobs technically because they're under contract at a different wage rate. So just something I had heard from a couple of union contractors, actually, who were frustrated because they couldn't bid the public projects anymore. So, any other questions, comments? I appreciate, gentlemen, you being here and helping us stay on time and finishing up this conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Colleagues, it was... luckily, they didn't leave, but I wanted to welcome Representative Peluso and Representative Wilson as committee members who will be joining us in February. And I know they're excited to be on this committee, as is all of you.
And Lucky. You forgot and Lucky.
Yeah.
Somebody ticked off the speaker. Yeah.
So also, colleagues, our drafting deadlines are up, and I did want to comment just briefly on committee bills going forward. I'm still have one bill that is yet to be decided as a committee bill, and actually talked to Representative Barreto, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk tomorrow about that and determining whether one bill is going to be a committee bill or not. But we are going to be having a committee bill on a work group that Representative Evans worked on with the auto dealers or auto sales folks around mechanic liens. So it's technical, but looks like they've come to an agreement on this particular work group. So I think that'll be a non-controversial bill, if there is such a thing out of this committee. And thanks for knocking on the wood. And another committee bill that will be coming is also around the performing artist and the wineries and
music and stuff and the
restaurants, you know, just copyright issues. So that hopefully won't be too controversial either. And so those are two that I know. The third one we're looking at is related to building codes. And we're still in conversations about what's going to happen with that. It's a little bit more involved than we thought for February. So we'll see how that plays out a little bit. So, Representative Kinnaman.
There's also a work group, I guess, working on the Equifax issue.
Yes, indeed, there is. We are working on that. I joined that work group with... after the last legislative days, Senator Brzezinski was doing a Senate committee work group, and we decided that the House needed to join that work group. So Jan's been in attendance, and I've been in attendance, and we are meeting tomorrow, actually, for that work group to see. And we have recommendations from the Department of Justice on a bill around that, so there may be a bill on that as well from the Senate, and there may be one from the House as well. So those decisions haven't been made quite yet. You know, we always wait till the last day usually to make those decisions. So
it's kind of a tough topic.
It is, you know. It's tough to get tough topics done in a short period of time, but albeit I think this committee can handle tough topics in an expeditious manner. Other than that, you know, if you have bills that you think are going to be coming to this committee or are aware of any that you want to advocate for coming to this committee, I would advise that... you let me know that ahead of January, because our time is very, very short, and I probably won't be able to deal with all the bills that get assigned to this committee in the short time we have. So there will be a bit of prioritizing, perhaps. So with that, I really appreciate you being here on a nice, bright Wednesday afternoon, and... again, welcome Representative Wilson and Representative Peluso.
Thank you very much.
With that, thank you, Ashley, for being our committee assistant today, and Jan, our administrator. With that, LPRO analyst, actually. With that, I'll adjourn the House Interim Committee on Business and Labor. On it here.